This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers.
AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing to fantastic, irreverent reviews, to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes that there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for just $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. Again, 30 days for free on Shudder. Just go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES.
In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. And now, this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue 4. We're celebrating in style. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. If you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, issue number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. That's SHOCKWAVES for 10% off at Fangoria.com.
You know where the Shockwave team shops for horror, cult, and strange films? Diabolik DVT, which features demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online right now at www.diabolikdvd.com. That's DIABOLIKDVD.com. Right now at Diabolik, Marion Dora's Harsinoma on Blu-ray with a limited edition slipcase. Also, all of the Agfa and Something Weird titles, including Ninja Zombie, Blood Lake, and Lady Street Fighter. And also all the latest from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. For all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook. Okay, and welcome to episode 144 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G., freshly back from Texas Frightmare with Elric Kane.
I'm here, man. We survived.
We survived the trip.
Like being rock stars for once in our life.
I know, and no trouble getting home this time, thankfully.
That's right.
Also, because you had me.
Because Ryan Turek, our lucky charm, Ryan Turek.
Actually,
we
had Jason Patrick.
Jason Patrick was the reason. Jason Patrick doesn't sit down on the plane when they tell you to.
The only reason that's amusing is because I kept going to these guys, I think that's Jason Patrick standing over there. We couldn't tell, and then he stood up and he's wearing a Lost Boys shirt.
and we're like, that's
Jason Patrick.
Also, Rebecca McKendry.
Hey.
Hello. You survived as well.
It was exhausting.
They made an announcement, no peanuts on our plane.
Yep.
It was
because
awesome.
Of you.
Fly Delta.
What happened is it triggered a friendship between Rob and an elderly woman on the plane.
Hey. Yeah. Roberta's my buddy now.
Fuck that shit. I don't care if she's your buddy.
Shit going on.
Does she listen to Shockwaves now?
I hope so.
I don't know.
I can't remember. I even told her.
She follow you on Facebook now.
Roberta.
She was very concerned about you, Becca. That was where our conversation started. And I said, that's my friend they're talking about.
That's sweet.
And she had hard-boiled eggs and peanuts. And I was like, you can't eat that because I'm going to ride in the car with her later and it will be trouble.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Anyways.
Thank you, Roberta.
Could you eat the egg?
Yes.
Why'd you have to bring that into
I gave her permission to eat the eggs.
Okay. It's fun. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Riveting podcast.
I know.
Right,
like, riveting intro.
Yeah. That was really – I know you guys are really into it. So.
But we also brought somebody else from Texas, believe it or not, who's not from Texas at all.
We brought him back in our carry-on.
He came with us regardless.
Do the accent. I want Texan.
For the Texan. For the first half of the show, we've got – Ewan Kent from Arrow Films with us.
Good evening, my unconventional conventionist. It's a
good Rocky Horror quote. They won't get it because they've never been.
Oh, God damn it.
Exactly. I know. I've tried.
Just a little Rocky Horror anecdote for you, actually. I managed to miss out on Scaryoki. Scaryoki?
Scaryoki, yeah.
That's what they called it, yeah.
So last year, I would like to say I brought the house down with a rendition of Sweet Transvestite.
Oh.
This year, I was... So, like, you know, you need... With the karaoke, like, you, I mean, for me anyway, my modus operandi is to, like, stand at the bar, get a few drinks, watch what's going on, kind of read the room a bit. And some guy got up and did Sweet Transvestite before I had the chance to get my request in.
And his name was Meatloaf.
Devastating. I think he might have been gone by that.
He had fallen by that point.
He had a problem,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
But I would have been there to scream hallelujah at the exact correct moment.
Well, we can close with my rendition if you want.
I'll call back line that shit till the end of time.
I'm glad to hear that Scaryoki did eventually take off, because that evening we saw G. Tom Mack perform A Lost Boys Story, the musical.
The musical.
About 45 minutes before Scaryoki began, and I understand the Scaryoki went on late because the fans just could not handle the awesomeness of G. Tom Mack.
That was exactly what I heard, yeah.
You missed it. I think, me and Ryan were at the bar and we're like, he's on now, we have to go.
We gotta go.
Because we're like,
I want to hear him sing Cry Little Sister.
When else are you going to see Cry Little Sister live? So that was what we were going for. We didn't expect that we got there with plenty of time to spare to make it through the Lost Boys musical.
Which includes cover tracks from INXS.
Yes, that was true. Forgot about
21
that.
21 Pilots.
Yes.
David Bowie.
There was some David Bowie in there,
and then there was
a kind of
pop song.
Moulin Rouge-esque musical where it's a lot of licensed
hits. He did some original songs, and there was like a pop song that the kids today know, but I don't.
Neither of us did.
Mattress and like staying up all late. I don't know. What the fuck it is.
There was a song. He broke out poetry book for the Frog Brothers
the Book
song.
Of Frog.
But what really, honestly, I was just blown away because there was a video of him singing every song behind him as he sang every song. Mm-hmm. And so that level of commitment and meta, I was kind of like, I don't know what I'm watching, but I kind of got respect for you, man, that you went on this elaborate production for this convention. It's great.
It was G. Tom Mack in 4D.
It was. Wow. And we were all pretty baffled. And then the moment he sang Cry Little Sister, everybody pulled their phones out.
Well, if you want to go to my Instagram page, I made a permanent story on there. So if you want to go back
permanent.
And see the hits.
When you say they pulled out their phones, was that because they were bored or because they were filming it?
They were all filming it became the Instagrammable moment of the entire
event.
Missed it. Yeah, you missed it, man.
I was too busy sucking myself up in the wings.
Should have gone Sword of Damocles. Crowd stopper every time.
You didn't
time.
Have a backup at all? Just that one song?
Well, do you want to hear what I did in the end?
Oh, what'd you do?
You're gonna be upset. Crazy Town Butterfly.
Oh.
Oh,
does that mean
wow.
anything to any of you guys?
The Come My Lady, Come My
that's
Lady.
That's the one, yeah.
My gosh.
I think I opened it by shouting, like, who remembers 2001?
I may have gyrated to that song in a club once.
See, if you'd been there, you'd have loved it.
Yeah. Wow.
I would have. I think I was eating beef jerky and prepping for a panel at that exact moment.
Yeah,
so,
that's the only way you can do it.
Yeah, I know. So my favorite part of the con, Ernie.
Ernie, our sound engineer. He's like, what's up, man?
But you didn't even need to travel for that then. He's right here.
I know. Everybody was so excited to meet Ernie. Yeah. And Ernie had never been to a horror con before.
First horror con, you were with your cousin, right?
That's right.
And you and your cousin were like, oh, man, this shit is crazy.
Yeah. And that was it. Every single time I would see Ernie walking around, I would see him upstairs and then, you know, back down at the booth. That would be his face is, yo, man, this shit's crazy. And I was like, this is awesome.
Love it.
We had fans that wanted to meet Ernie and everybody was really excited he was there and was part of the troupe traveling with us. So I love
it. Very cool.
Ernie groupies. I like it.
Yeah.
But it did grow a lot. Like, I mean, we all noticed like – we were in the big hall for the first time ever.
They put
ever.
Us at the big table this time,
and
guys.
It definitely felt different in terms of like kind of, I mean, the first time we were there, it was like 20 people came up to us wearing shirts and stuff. And now each year it seems to grow. That photo you put up online.
Well, yeah, it was pretty huge. And yeah, we had a great show. You'll hear that, I think, in another week
May
24th. Or two.
Yeah. We're going to put it on May 24th.
See it because it had a visual component, so we wanted to shoot it, which we did. So we're excited about that. And I mean, basically – there's one thing that we could talk about, which ties into our current guest sitting in the room that we saw at Texas Fright there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Ewan's wearing a Mutilator shirt. So for everyone, people have requested Arrow to come on the show. So there's going to be a tease because I'd like to coordinate and have you and any of the other gang from the Arrow team as a full-on guest to talk about history of the company and all. But You're the reason for The Mutilator on Blu-ray and I believe Blood Rage or what was the other? Blood Rage.
Yep.
You are the reason now that we saw The Prey.
Yes, I'm. Well, you saw it before, though. You told me that.
Why don't you preface the AJ story again?
That was back from Killer POV, right?
It was full circle. Basically, AJ Bowen was our guest at the live Killer POV at Texas Frightmare and was describing this movie.
5 years ago.
Yeah, 5 years ago. He was like, there's this movie. Nobody's ever been able to identify it. He described it a little bit about it's in the woods and blah, blah, blah. And someone in the audience to me was like, The Prey. And he's like, oh my God, I love you so much. I've never heard
of
this movie.
The part was because of the mountain. The person hanging off the mountain. So that, 'cause that was the only part I remembered watching it, like looking for it. I was like, when's that part gonna
It was happen? That description and somebody nailed it right away. And immediately after that, we identified it because it was only on VHS. Actually, it's really funny. He couldn't find the VHS for a reasonable rate. He ordered a bootleg DVD. And so we got it and it looked so bad that we just went and watched it on YouTube because it was also on YouTube and it looked slightly better on YouTube than it did there. But we watched it and we thought, okay, that's pretty interesting, mainly because it was, shot in 79 or so or 80?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was all pre the Friday 13th franchise and there's a lot of elements from Friday 1-3 that are in there. Like a lot that you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Cut to 5 years later, and I don't even know. Maybe it was actually 4 years, like last year when I asked you, I think this title came up because we were talking about The Mutilator, and you're like, oh, we're doing The Prey. And I'm like, what? Really? For real? And also, by the way, Edge of the Axe, which is another kind of legendary long lost VHS slasher.
And great computer action on that.
Yeah, way ahead of its time.
So The Prey, do you want to talk about how you felt about it first, Elric?
I was very excited to be kind. Yeah, no, I had fun with it. I mean, I think it's a great group viewing film. I think my first initial reaction to you was it's just the most realistic slasher ever shot. I believe it's every moment of the film. It's every getting on the pack and walking has a killer banjo scene.
including the tuning up
A full tuning banjo scene. But the reason you said it's so realistic is because it's all in real time.
Yeah, like, it feels very real time. But it is one of those films that I think lulled me into once it kind of gets going, because a lot of it's just kind of – I mean, it's very funny. And especially like there's a sequence where the guy's trying to touch his girlfriend's boob and she just keeps asking for if he loves her. And,
tell me you love me.
I know. It's such a good scene. So it has
– I love you, goddammit. I love you.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who likes slashers is going to like it. It's going to have fun with it. But it wasn't till it kind of gets into that last act that the horror film side of it really kicks in. There's this particular gag where I feel like you get maximum engagement suddenly.
Yeah.
I don't want to ruin it for people, but so I thought it was fun. But it also is very into its nature photography.
It does.
There's lots of shots of birds just watching and trees being.
Elric, when they came out of the screening, I met them and we went for dinner. And the very first thing that Elric said to me is, "You're going to like this, Becca, because there's a lot of footage of bugs."
Yeah, which is, could be on the poster. I'm thinking, but there's a really fun. I like how kind of black humor it ends, and so without spoiling stuff. So I actually think it's a fun movie. It's just you never know what your expectations are of a film like that.
Well, it played much better enough. Packed audience for Texas Frightmare, and even better was like
that was insane. Like, when we were like prepping to like go to the screening, and people were like, oh my God, there's queues all the way down. Like it was just mental. I mean, I don't know like how we managed to kind of get that many people to come, but I think we'd packed out the room pretty much.
I think it was your poster and everything.
Yeah, the poster.
And Joe Rubin, we bumped into Joe Rubin from Vinegar Syndrome, who's been on the show right before, and he's like, there's more people in this room to see The Prey than its entire theatrical run.
Yeah. that is literally true.
That is true, right?
So what was the history of, like, just how did it, was it just in drive-ins and then disappeared, or what was it?
We've got a few newspaper ads that confirmed that it had like a handful of screenings here and there, but it was blink and you miss. I think it was in for like a couple of weeks. But New World did distribute it in 84. They picked it up in 84. It sat on the shelf for about 4 years, which is part of the bizarre and interesting history of the movie.
Wow. Yeah, because it has, again, some Friday stuff that now feels like it would have come out after.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, one of the big conundrums that I had to figure out with researching the film was it's, when exactly it was made. So it's like 1984 is obviously, that's what's generally quoted as the year because it's the release year. It's copyrighted to 1980. Even when I interviewed the filmmakers, I went out to meet them for the first time this time last year, after kind of trying to coax them out of hiding for 3 or 4 years. They even thought it was made in 1980 until I got around to interviewing Debbie, who plays the sort of final girl, not to spoil things. She plays Nancy. And she had saved like her script. She had saved the call sheets. So we've literally got, you know, a list of when every shot, every scene was filmed, which proved it was 1979. They shot it 2 weeks, like Monday to Friday, 2 weeks in the end of October, mm-hmm. With some pickups in 1980. And we also, and crazily enough, I was talking with David Gregory from Severin. I was in their offices again this time last year, and I was talking to him about The Prey, and he's like, The Prey, I'm sure I've got some like cans of film that say The Prey somewhere. I'm sure they say like outtakes. And I was like, oh, what? And I was just like, this can't be true. But it turned out there was cans of outtakes from The Prey that were just sitting in someone's storage unit.
Wow.
The people who own the storage unit don't even know how they got there. And so we've got 45 minutes of
outtakes
from The Prey, which have like the clapperboards and everything, and you can see all like the crew members and what they look like then. So like we can actually see from the clapperboards that it verifies that that's when it was made. So it's kind of we're going super granular on this.
I can't believe it. And here's the thing, like Jim Koons had been shooting a lot of footage of the behind the scenes with you.
We had a ball.
Yeah, I was talking, it was right before Tice Freeman, I was talking to your colleague Mike Hewitt from Arrow, and he was telling me just how excited you were to like, where was it, Lake Arrowhead or something? Or like somewhere up there?
It was filmed up in Idlewild.
Idlewild.
Yeah.
That you were
beautiful.
So excited.
I love Idlewild so much.
It's awesome. It's my second time. And I was just obsessed with getting the exact shot from the grotto scene where the guy is like sliding down the rock into the water and then they're all frolicking stuff. So
that's a great scene.
Jim Koons was just an absolute trooper. I went there last year and like I found the grotto. And so I remember thinking, oh, it's actually, you know, I've done the hard part. I know where it is. It's fine. But we ended up coming at it from a completely different angle this time. And I had Jim in tow with the camera. I had Debbie, who played Nancy. And the producer, Summer Brown, joined us as well. And it ended up being like an hour hike through like a rugged landscape and like shimmying across rocks and stuff until we finally got there. And I just kept turning around to them saying like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I hope this is okay. Jim was like, are you kidding? I love this shit, man. And
he's a ball.
Was there
of
still
energy.
Water there? Like to frolic in? Or?
Yeah, it was a bit. Yeah, because I think they'd had snow till quite late. So the water was a bit higher up. I was able to slip on my trunks and recreate some water frolicking.
But if it's made in 79, there's no way that the entire film could take place in the dream sequence of part 3. Correct? Because our theory is that it's all the flashback of Friday the 13th, part 3, where rapey Jason could have happened. I think this is really a parallel story. So you're going to have to watch these two movies back to back together.
Yeah. I like the idea of that. You can cut them together.
I do think you could. Supercut. This is the backstory we've all been waiting for.
Yeah, totally.
Before we move on, why your obsession with slasher movies? Because I know you love all kinds of movies, and obviously Arrow does a lot of really interesting thing, whether it be celebrate the work of, you know, the early work of Romero, like that box set's great. You guys just did the De Niro De Palma box set. Mm. But you're the guy that goes to bat for Mutilator and Blood Rage. As he should.
As he should.
But like, why? Did you, I mean, was that just a big part of your upbringing, loving slasher films or?
I mean, loving horror films in general, but I guess, you know, I mean, my first, I came on as a producer, so, you know, like producing releases, commissioning artwork, creating the extras, and then I managed to kind of muscle my way into more of the acquisition stuff by just kind of identifying films that I wanted to own on Blu-ray and that I thought other people might get a kick out of. Mm-hmm. And the first one of those was Blood Rage and Mutilator, and I think around the same time, I just kind of started to specialize in slasher films. There was a website called terrortrap.com that really kind of turned me on to like seeking out some of the more obscure ones. And I just kind of went down that rabbit hole and just kind of became quite obsessed. And the taglines and the artwork, they're just some of the best in the genre for me. That's, you know, what I get a real kick out of. And especially with The Mutilator was a really special one because that's the first time I came to the US. I came to North Carolina to stay with the director who shot the movie on the beach, and he runs the motel where it was
Big
all shot.
Ed? like
big, not Big Ed. Well, Big Ed's the killer. Yeah,
okay.
There's a few Eds.
I was like,
yeah. No, Buddy Cooper was the.
No, no, not that Big Ed directed it. Like, did you track Big Ed's like movements? And
Well, that's kind of a funny story, but I kind of got there thinking because the motel's there, the beach is there, the pool that they have the wonderful scene in is the hotel pool. The condo is like just on the other side of the parking lot. And so you just think, okay, well, the director's obviously going to know where absolutely everything is. And we were wandering around trying to do some location stuff. And we did this whole skit where me and a couple of the leads, like the two final teenagers, are in the garage and they're like mucking around and reenacting some stuff. So we do all that. We film all that. And we come out of the garage and we walk round the side of the condo. And then the director looks at the other condo and says, actually, I think it was that house. I think he's rectified that now because they literally, and I was so devastated, but this weekend just passed. Obviously, it's great to be in Texas Frightmare, but they had a screening the condo and they had all that stuff. So I think he's now identified the exact house. But it was kind of funny.
What happened to the blonde guy? Because I always thought he's maybe the worst actor I've ever seen.
But
he has the best death.
Maury Lampley. Yes.
That's one of my favorite death scenes with that whatever rotating blade.
Yeah, and he's got a very shiny chest.
But he's just a weird performance.
Yeah.
But I love, I'm really glad you put that one out because that's a fave for sure.
Yeah, I just need to find the next one now. I mean, I keep joking about I call it my The Trilogy, The Mutilator, The Slayer, The Prey.
Oh, The Slayer. That's right.
Well, The Slayer has a great last moment. There was a lot to get to that moment, but that last moment.
I feel like I need to revisit The Slayer to fully appreciate it.
Great cover. Also one of the best covers. Yeah. Like that post art is
And the trailer. The trailer's really good, too.
And the tagline in the trailer. Yeah. If it's a nightmare, then why is everybody dead?
Did you also do Scalpel? Because that was when you recommended
that. Yes, yeah.
I love Scalpel a lot.
Scalpel I came to actually because of Blood Rage, because it's the same director. Yeah.
But it's a great little movie. And the other one we really liked last year that we talked about a bit about was Madhouse.
Madhouse,
which I hadn't really known much about before that.
You know, it doesn't comply with your The Trilogy, but I'll just drop that. Three on a Meat Hook has not had an appropriate Blu-ray release.
Yeah, Three on a Meat Hook. I'm a fan of that one. Yeah. On my radar.
I always found that one, and I'm not even a slasher person. I was always for More Creatures.
Yeah.
But I always found that one rather
fascinating. And that's the one with the trailer that has loads of footage that's not in the film.
Yes, and then Three on a Meat Hook, but there's only two on a Meat Hook on the VHS.
I love that. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And Ryan's team, Doom Asylum.
I love
but not so much Scared Stiff, which is hilarious because Elric and I were at the pre screening, and you showed the Scared Stiff trailer, and it starts out, and we're both like, "Oh, this looks pretty cool." And it's like from the really director good. Of Doom Asylum, and then both of us are like, "Oh," and then it kept going, and
how
we're like,
"Dare you?
Wait a minute, this is actually really cool.
It actually looked really good.
Maybe we're opposite Ryan on
our
taste.
How can you not like Doom Asylum? I mean,
no, I liked it. I enjoyed the experience.
Yeah,
no, I didn't like it.
Fair enough.
It's got
one of the best drill to the head gags I've seen. Yeah. I will say that.
That is pretty good.
It's the one-liners that took me down eventually. It was just too much Freddy impressions.
So many good ones. Yeah. So many.
They're a bit late.
So many pieces of gold, and you're just ignoring it.
And when they turn that woman into the kind of the cube of meat with the spring coming out of it. That's
pretty good. When is The Prey coming out? Do you have a date for it yet or tentatively?
Not dated, but we're looking at September. We've been putting together the extras for quite some time, so that's looking good. And the restoration that we showed last weekend is pretty much the final thing. There's a few bits to be ironed out, but it's pretty much good to go. So yeah, September's looking good.
What's your that tagline? It's not human, and it's got an axe.
Yeah, that's I love that tagline.
That's a great one.
But it is human, and it only has an axe temporarily.
Valid. Okay.
That's not going to help you sell this movie.
We should do accurate taglines where we just edit taglines to be accurate.
If rights be damned, is there a slasher that you would, you know, if the rights weren't an issue, that you would have loved to have released? Or are they all kind of out there?
You picked me on the spot. I would love to. I mean, I've got a bit of big love for Leatherface, Chainsaw Massacre 3.
If you could do the unrated
I would love
version,
to. Get Jeff Burr on board and, I don't know, root around in Warner Vaults and try and pull out. I mean,
amazing.
I know Rob's a big fan of that as well.
I love it,
Pull out the, I don't know if they still exist, but, you know, the work prints and compiler.
That'd be cool.
A faithful version of that would be awesome.
That's a good answer.
Oh, you have Trapped Alive coming out in June, right?
Yeah, we screened that at Frightmare as well.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, awesome.
We did.
Yeah.
And you screened the one I couldn't stay up for, but I wanted to see was The Child, which is part of the next...
The long-awaited American Horror
Project. Yeah, which are just always interesting. And I just love all the work you guys put into those, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, more work than anyone will ever know, really.
Yeah, yeah. But, and Stephen Throw is a great voice piece.
Yes, this, yeah. No, I was really happy to. I mean, we meet up quite regularly because he's, you know, just outside of London. And, you know, he was really on board with figuring out exactly which titles we wanted, which we could get. I mean, there's, you know, if I had like a few hours, I could go on about stuff that we couldn't get or reasons we couldn't get stuff or why certain things take so long. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was great that we settled on, cause you know, we set the bar pretty high with the last set, and people were constantly asking about when the next one was coming out. So there was quite a lot of pressure, you know, not to have a sophomore slump. I was really happy with the response. I think we put mm-hmm. together a collection of three interesting films. Some people had heard of, some people hadn't.
Yeah, not a lot of them. I think I'd heard the title of one, but haven't seen any of the three. So
yeah,
I'm excited.
I mean, Child is, yeah, that's kind of like that's the flagship.
The only one I've heard.
What were the other two again?
I'm excited to see the others.
Dream No Evil, 71 mm-hmm. by John Hayes, uh-huh. and Dark August by Martin Goldman.
That's the one I feel like I've heard the title, but definitely don't know what the what is the idea behind that one?
It's a regional oddity shot in Vermont about a man who kills this girl in a hit-and-run accident, and he then finds himself pursued by her grandfather, who may or may not have put a curse on him.
What's it called again? August Hayes?
Dark August.
Oh, Dark August.
Dark August. Six.
Yeah, interesting.
Dark August.
Yep. Old man curse movie.
That's it. That's,
I shouldn't do subgenres there. Thinner. Cool.
All right, let's dive into what we've seen. I know Ryan is dying to talk about some killer cats.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, Elric and I are dying to talk about killer dinosaurs.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Jesus. Yes. We got themes.
Brain transplants.
Who wants to go first? Catch a dinosaurs.
Oh, well, you want to lead it?
Okay.
I guess that's a hard thing to follow when you have cats or dinosaurs, but Jesus.
So we went to, I don't know, was it a
I was sure
screening?
We already talked about this on the show, but I guess we haven't.
We have not talked about this.
It was an AGFA, you're all invited. They reached out to individual people to have a secret screening.
Is this what you're talking about?
Tammy and the T-Rex.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, no, it was amazing, and it was
guys,
gore.
I'll be back.
No, guys.
Dude, sit your tush down.
This has got gore in it.
So we saw, a secret screening of Tammy and the T-Rex. This is from 1994. Now, I had actually seen this a lot on VHS.
But not the gore version.
Not the gore version. So this is Denise Richards and
Early
Paul Walker. Yeah. And the whole concept is that Denise Richards
from the director of Mac and Me.
From the director of Mac and Me.
So now you're in.
Well, and he directed something else because midway through the movie, I'm literally sitting there and I go, this is like the entire cast of Mannequin 2. And so then I pull out my phone and I start Googling and he also did Mannequin 2.
All right, you're saying all these things that I really like. So
now he's in. Now he's in. Wait till you get to
Mac and Me. Hang on a second.
John Carpenter.
The story is that this girl, Tammy, is deeply in love with this guy played by Paul Walker. And but this like ruffian biker, I don't think he has a bike. I think he just has like a badass car.
But he owns her.
But Roach, he owns her and his sidekick Roach from People Under the Stairs. Yep. And they're like, no, we're taking down Pete Walker. And so one day they like beat him up and he dies.
After grabbing each other's crutches for a very,
very long
amount of
time.
They're both squeezing in a scene that
Paul
lasts
Walker's
about
doing
5 minutes.
Crab?
Yeah, there's major nut
I'm
crab
not kidding when
this.
I say it goes on for about five.
It's literally like
past
5 minutes.
The point of comfort.
Like daring each other to let go. It's weird. But fine. So the head of this horrible gang, they beat the crap out of the Paul Walker character.
They don't just
and
beat
he dies.
Him. They drive him to a wildlife sanctuary and beat him there and then leave him in the wild for no reason at all.
So he can be eaten by
so
a jaguar.
So suddenly black panthers and tigers are coming after him. You're like, whoa, this is like Fast and Furious shit.
It's a very it's Bond wild. Villain it style is. Death. But anyway, getting to the point that Paul Walker has died.
No, he's in coma. He is in a coma.
He is in a coma.
And a mad scientist from across town.
A mad scientist from across town, played by Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's.
Jerry Kaiser.
Who chain smokes, and his very buxom assistant come in and decree that he is dead, and so therefore they can take his little coma body and use it for their own experiments. So
can
then,
I say what that is? Because I'm so excited.
Yes, go ahead.
They take his brain out of his head, and I mean gruesomely, like violently open Paul Walker's head.
Like
take his brain
cranium,
out.
Cranium, bone, skull, hacking.
And they put it in a full life-size Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Sure. Sure.
That is like, I don't know what they were going to do with it otherwise. The Tyrannosaurus Rex, I think it had an android brain. But they're like, let's try it with a human brain.
It had a computer brain because it was your brain can never beat my computer. But it did because it was Paul Walker. So Paul Walker is now in a T-Rex. Yeah. And his girlfriend Tammy is all like, my boyfriend's dead. And so now the T-Rex has to go find.
That's the nut called.
T-Rex has to go find Tammy and tell her what has been done to him.
Pull up the trailer
but
while you
listen. But he's a T-Rex and he can't talk. So he has to, there is a scene where they play charades to get Tammy to understand that Paul Walker's brain has been put inside of his little hands go up to his little head.
And she goes, oh, your head? No. Oh, your brain. Your brain's in the dinosaur? And you're just watching go, oh, wow.
But here's the thing.
And he picks up a little phone at one point.
Yeah, he picks up a little phone and tries to call her, but he can't talk because he's a T-Rex.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. God. This is so fucking gory. John Carbuechler did all the effects for this. And it's not just the one scene where they actually have the full brain removal.
No, there's a scene where people get squashed.
They get their guts ripped out. There's impalements.
He goes on. He basically gets revenge on the people who are punishing him.
He goes on a full rampage. He rips people's heads out. All of the effects are just as brilliant as you would want them to be.
So you're saying this is like the Wraith, but with a dinosaur?
Basically.
That's pretty much it. A little bit less sheen, a little bit less.
But the version everyone's seen has had all the good stuff. I mean, a lot of the good stuff. There's a lot of sexual stuff. But all the really great gory stuff was all gone all these years. So AGFA, I guess, has restored it.
I had no recollection. And I mean, I watched this a lot as a kid, and I had no recollection of any of these gory scenes. So whatever this was, it was not in whatever was playing on like TNT when I was a kid. Because I remember watching it on television.
All you need to know is there's a part where she's literally riding the T-Rex off in the distance, and one of the cops, who's just basically an extra, just looks at the other cop and goes, man, can she ride? And it might be one of the greatest moments I've ever seen in a movie. You're just like, wow.
This is not Ernie approved. Ernie's like,
I think it opens with the weirdest cheerleading segment ever because it opens with a cheerleading dance where we're clearly trying to establish Denise Richards as like the sexualized beauty of the high school.
But
the whole thing is shot from like ankle level looking up. And it feels really weird.
It felt great. Just face it. Paul Walker was totally happy with it. He runs in. But the nut holding was very strange.
The nut holding was. Really there was a lot to this movie that
But I
got to
say,
strange.
Like, I was not a believer. She was the one who said, no, you really should. It's worth your time. As a third, do I really need to see that? It was secret, so it's kind of intriguing. I got to say, it was probably the most fun we'll have in the theater this year.
And it's the most L.A. fucking thing in the world.
Well, they wanted to control, like, they want to get word out. I don't think it's going to be till later in the year.
Yeah.
So they were kind of trying to pepper it out to see how people would react.
I think Bloody Disgusting ran something today about Tammy and the T-Rex.
So did AV Club, Cinepocalypse to screen R-rated gore cut of Tammy and the T-Rex.
You will have fun, but it is a party movie for sure.
Who dares follow that, Ryan?
Tell us about your cats.
Well, my cat can one-up your T-Rex.
Okay.
This is also a party movie. A few episodes back, we had on Vinegar Syndrome, and during that recording, I felt the power. And I felt compelled to buy Uninvited. Sight Unseen,
this
kooky cat movie, and it just felt right. It felt right, and I'm glad I now have this in my collection. I didn't realize who had directed it. It's written and directed by Graydon Clark. Before he did this in '88, he had done Without Warning. He had done Satan's Cheerleaders.
Nice.
A bunch of other wacky titles. And I haven't seen all of them. I mean, I guess he did Joysticks, which I guess kids in the 80s grew up with, but I never saw it. He did a movie called Dance Macabre, which you have seen and talked about.
Oh, I've seen Dance Macabre.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I actually really enjoy that one.
I can't imagine he had topped himself in his body of work because The Uninvited is pure gold. As far as names...
Wait, didn't Severin also put out a cat
one?
No.
That's Elric.
Oh, is this part of a double story?
Hold,
okay,
sir,
I'm excited.
Hold. You've got George Kennedy in this. You got Clu Gulager in this. But the main focus is on a bunch of three party dudes and two spring break babes who are hanging out in Fort Lauderdale and looking for a good time. And what happens is they wind up on a yacht owned by a rich Wall Street crook who is basically he was on the run for something. George Kennedy and Clu play his like thugs, his henchmen, and their whole goal is to get to the Cayman Islands, because this Wall Street guy, picked up these two babes at a bar. He's like, hey, come along. they're like, great. But then they bring on these three dudes. One of them happens to be a biologist. And along the way, they discover a cat on the dock who has been thrown into basically like a utility shed. And they're like, oh my God, look at this kitty. And they take the cat out and the cat's got a collar. And one of them's like, oh, that's a collar from like a science lab. This cat's been experimented on. That should have concerned them, because what they don't know is that the cat is a vessel for something deadly inside. Well, Ewan, have you seen this movie?
I haven't, but oh,
good God.
On the edge of my seat.
Yeah. This basically, it is a creature that is cat-like and is basically wearing like a cat suit, as Ciara called
it. I've seen enough stills to make me want it.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And every so often, this thing crawls out of the cat to maim and infect people with its bite.
Nice.
En route to the Cayman Islands.
Yeah.
The ship breaks down. There's only the captain, so there's no real crew. So, you know, the three party dudes and the two party babes and the two henchmen and this Wall Street crook all need to band together to really get this ship going. And they can't, because this fucking cat keeps picking them off one by one and infecting them with its bite, or just destroying them.
Yeah.
And when you get infected by its bite, you get some pretty gnarly bladder effects where your like veins start popping and then you just explode in blood. It's pretty fun. But I gotta be straight up with you. This movie's terrible.
Oh,
it is a terrible fucking movie. There's weird continuity errors. There's puzzling character motivations. There's dopey scientists. There's uneven performances. I'm getting there. Okay. But my favorite thing out of all of this is the completely inept sound mix and sound design. The cat runs around the entire movie meowing, regardless if its mouth is opening or closing. There's a big car accident that occurs in the first 20 minutes where the car races off a freeway and down a hill, and you hear the same glass explosion playing on loop. So it's just playing over and over and over, as opposed to, you know, a rich, you know, fulfilling sound design.
Ryan demands a rich landscape of every movie.
Well, you know, at least give me something as opposed to the same sound effect over and over and over again. And you get tired of the cat meowing, because it's the exact same sound effect over and over and over again.
Wow.
What else? You know, there's
glad Graydon Clark isn't our guest today.
Oh God, it's awful.
This would get ugly.
The other great thing is just kind of watching the continuity errors, because they're actually like, they're on a boat on the ocean and it's like incredibly windy. So you'll get coverage of two people talking together and they'll cut to like George Kennedy and it's like a blustery take and you just hear wind drowning out his dialogue. And then you'll cut to the reverse of the actress listening to him and it's completely silent and there's no wind whatsoever. So it's just like, and then it just cuts to like completely clean audio.
This is pretty much the hardest you've ever sold me on a film. I am in. Like everything there, I will watch.
No, it's definitely so something. Cool it's definitely there. Something you need to see with friends or a big crowd. It delivers on the so bad it's good. Uh-huh. It is incredibly enjoyable. You kind of wonder why Clue makes the choice to wear really bad dentures to give him buck teeth.
Bless Clue Gulagray's choices.
And you know what? Bless him, because he chose to be an actor in the film that dies right away, so he doesn't have to commit very much. Same with George Kennedy. George Kennedy and Clue Gulager do not last very long because they probably don't need to endure all the shit in this film.
But this cat puppet is making me giggle.
The cat
I'm looking
puppet,
it online.
It's a cat that vomits a cat monster.
Cat monster.
That's what I'm looking at right now. It's literally
that image is amazing.
Yeah. So you get the amazing cat puppet that comes out of the cat's mouth,
which looks like a little version of Zool from Ghostbusters.
Just thinking, cats and boats do not go together in my brain at all. It's exactly. What are you like? What?
Speaking of boats, you get a terrific multiple shots of terrific miniature boat in a bathtub during a storm.
Oh, nice.
You get the cat puppet.
Why is the cat with pancake mix?
Okay, that's I don't want to unpack that right now, Becca.
Okay. There's literally a picture of the cat, and it's very like framed next to pancake mix.
But it's next to
the pancake mix is in focus more so than the cat.
But you're asking the wrong question. Why is the box of pancake mix stark white and it just says pancake mix?
Well, maybe it's from Repo Man.
Double Repo Man take. Good job.
Look, it's definitely something that I'm glad is part of my collection. I think Uninvited is my new obsession next to Mausoleum.
Oh, good. And, oh, wait, so it ends with a positive. This is a good movie that they should watch.
This is a great film that all of you should see.
Thank God.
I love it.
That's good.
Uninvited.
All right. So I want to know the rest because I got given the Uncanny and I'm going to watch it. So I don't want to know all the plot points. But how is it?
So the Uncanny is
also a cat movie of some kind.
It is a cat anthology, a British cat anthology. Are you familiar with Peter Cushing in this? Peter Cushing's in it.
Oh, I fucking seen this.
Yeah. So it's a British horror anthology directed by a Canadian filmmaker, Denny Haru. He had done a bunch of films in Canada, but strangely, he produced a lot of cartoons like Mask. He produced something called Jace and the Wheeled Warriors, which I remember growing up as a kid, but I was not a very big fan because, boy, that's a fucking terrible title. And he also, in theme with this, he also produced Heathcliff and the Cadillac Cats.
As in the cartoon?
As in the cartoon, yeah.
Wow, I used to watch that show a lot.
Well, it's from the director of The Uncanny. there's no Heathcliff in this, though. But basically, Peter Cushing plays an author who discovers that cats are evil and are supernatural creatures. And he writes a giant manuscript all about this, doing a lot of hard research. And the film begins with him racing to the streets to get to his publisher while he's being eyed by cats all over. And he gets to the publisher and he's like, cats are fucking evil and are supernatural. Here's why. And he tells you three tales of terror about evil cats. And his publisher has a lot of patience and listens to each story and tries to explain them away. But they're set all through the 1900s. So it's like the one in 1912, one in 1970s, one in 1930s. The problem with The Uncanny is it's a 1977 horror film at a time when horror is doing really exciting things by the late 1970s. And it is adhering to some very old tropes. You know, You've got the young couple who are trying to steal an inheritance from a dying woman. You've got Donald Pleasance who kills his wife because he wants to be with his mistress, and he's just trying to hide that murder. And these are like these very old school, you know, kind of stuffy British horror kind of tropes that you've seen in, you know, Dr. Terror's House of Horror and House of Drip Blood and stuff like that. The comeuppance is rich and delicious. I think that's where the kind of the joy comes in, is like, you stick around for these kinds of, these kind of tired tales just to see how everybody's going to die by the way of a cat. The second story is kind of interesting because it's about a bullied girl who is orphaned and her cousin is just a total piece of shit. And the little girl uses witchcraft to take her revenge, and the cat kind of plays a part in it. But Severin did a good job with the disc. I've never seen this anthology before. There's a lot of cats jumping off balconies, a lot of cats jumping off things, a lot of cats being thrown at people. Donald Pleasance is kind of a piece of shit in this movie, but it's fun watching him be a piece of shit. There is, I will say, for the animal lovers out there, trigger warning, because Donald Pleasance does something to a basket of kittens that is abominable.
Inferno-ish?
Like, it's kind of, it's really gnarly, to the point where Ciara stood up and she goes, did he just do what I think he did? And I was like, that sound effect was a toilet flushing, yes.
Oh.
And it's just completely dismissed. Like, he walks out, and his wife, his mistress is like, what are you going to do in here? Flush. And then he's like, okay, now moving on. And you're like, holy crap, I want you to die.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm going to assume that he gets his comeuppance.
Oh, big time.
Okay.
With a little bit of a kind of a Tales from the Crypt EC Comics.
So they flush him down the toilet.
No, don't spoil it all. Just think about.
They flush Donald Pleasance down the toilet.
Just think about any saying in which there's a cat and he kind of dies that way. But anyways, The Uncanny.
You might not know this, but so, okay, I haven't opened my Uncanny yet, but can I trade it in for The Uninvited? Because based on your views,
it's called two different
labels. But if you trade it to Arrow, they will broker a deal for you and send you the one you now want to watch. I like this idea. But anyway,
I'm just wondering, where's Arrow's cat entry? I mean, like, there's got
to
be something.
I know the one I want you to have.
Cat's Eye.
You guys put out Black Cat.
The Black Cat. Yep.
Yeah.
There we go.
Shot just outside London. We had a lot of fun going out and retracing the paw prints of the Black Cat with Mr. Stephen Throw.
But if we could get the rights from Code Red, who haven't really done anything with it, the greatest cat movie that I need to lend you to top all.
Oh, is this the one with the cats in the basement?
Is this the one with the cats in the basement?
They're all in
this thing, and he basically has 1,000 hungry, starving cats. He picks up woman in his helicopter. Probably the greatest thing of it.
That is the one. That's what I thought I was buying when I bought the Uncanny.
Yeah, this one only exists on the second of a double bill on a DVD that he has said, I'll never put it back out. No one ever buys it. And I have two copies just in case. I hold on to it like it's. Yeah, no.
I would love to watch this.
You need to watch this movie. It is. If somebody could pry that out of them, it is an incredible movie. It's not very long. It's only like 70 minutes or 67 minutes, but it's amazing. And there is one scene that might, you know, cat trigger alarm. But in general, of course, because it's made by a bunch of Italians. It's pretty well. I don't know if you haven't caught that. Oh, put on the radar.
The Night of a Thousand Cats.
But it's going to be hard to be uninvited.
I'm not even going to try. That one will, trust me. But I saw one that was interesting. Have you ever seen Initiation of Sarah?
Yes, that's an Australian film. I have.
This is an American college one. I'm confusing it
with Allison's Birthday.
Morgan Fairchild in it. Shelley Winters is.
I saw that a long time ago.
Yeah, Shelley Winters is the old head of some like really shitty fraternity. No, what are they called? Sorority that no one wants to be part of. And this girl and her sister, she's adopted. They come to a college campus. Her sister's perfect. Her sister kind of, this is like 78, I think. Her sister goes, pledges to Morgan Fairchild's, you know, perfect, all the best looking girl sorority and gets in, but her sister gets rejected. And part of her pledge week is she's not allowed to talk to her old sister anymore because she's a reject. The sister joins the reject sorority that has like five nerds and Shelley Winters, which is a great draw for a sorority. And Shelley Winters is hiding some room. And basically we learn that it's basically a ripoff of Carrie. So she basically has Carrie's powers, but it's a sorority and there's a pledge thing and there's some pretty cool stuff in it. It's not a great movie. I think it was on Amazon Prime where I caught it. I just like the title.
Tom Holland wrote it and it's on a double feature DVD with Are You in the House Alone? This is when Scream Factory is trying to do the TV Terrorist because it's a made-for-TV movie.
That's right,
It was super early in Tom's writing career.
And they remade it in 2006 for ABC Family.
Robert Hayes, who has Summer a drinking Glow. Problem and the airplane, is also in this, and he doesn't want to go too far with the hazing. Come on, we got to draw back. It was kind of fun seeing these people. Morgan Fairchild, though, it's kind of bizarre because it's like she doesn't age. Like she could, as in the sorority, she could literally be 40 or she could be 20. I just have no idea. She's got that look that she's pretty, but you're like, I have no idea how old you really are. Like, very strange. But it's actually a pretty good little movie. Definitely fits. I think there was quite a lot of Carrie-ploitation happening around then, and this is definitely
Carrie-ploitation.
Just coin that term.
I'll just throw anything down. I'll do mutilator exploitation if I have to. But anyway.
That's more like nautical exploitation.
Yeah,
exactly. Beach exploitation.
Yeah. But it's pretty fun. It's not revelatory and it has some good scenes. I'm a big Shelley Winters fan. I'll watch her in anything. And she was in literally everything. So,
What year was that from?
78.
Okay, so this was kind of around the time she was like slumming it in The Visitor.
Wait, slumming it in The Visitor?
No one slums in The Visitor.
The Visitor is A grade.
Re-release The Visitor. I'm not.
It's one of my favorite of your films.
And Tentacles, of course.
Of course.
One of the best
greatest
soundtracks.
Greatest soundtrack ever.
Yes. Love that soundtrack. Which is actually just recycled from other films mostly. Yeah. But anyway, that's that one.
Okay.
Did you watch anything?
I watched one thing, but I'll save it for the
end. I'll throw this one out really quick. I watched Mon Monsters, which is currently on Shudder. This is a Thai horror comedy, and it's fucking batshit. Like, that's the only way I can really describe this movie is there is just so much going on in it that there were times that I was like, I don't even know what's going on, but it's just, there's a lot. It's fun, but at the same time, it's got these really grueling torture sequences that really did kind of bother me. Like the woman level of torture sequences. So the whole setup is that it's in a high school and there's the cool kids and then there's this kid that they pick on mercilessly. They frame him to look like a total pervert in front of the rest of the school, and they end up framing him. They steal all this money from like one of the school's fundraisers, and they frame this kid. And so this kid is now being persecuted and being accused of stealing all this money. And one day he finds all these the cool kids kind of hanging out in a basement, and he approaches them. Somehow all of them get in trouble. the cool kids and the dweeby kid, and they are all forced to do community service together. And the community service that they're forced to do is kind of like a Meals on Wheels program at this apartment complex for – it's like an elderly apartment complex. And most of the people there don't really have all of their mental facilities, so they end up – and this is where some of the torture stuff comes in. They end up forcing them to like do elderly fights and things like that. Really brutal shit. Like they do it with like chicken fighting and things like that. So some really sadistic
chicken
stuff.
Chicken versus old person or just old chicken person, on chicken, old person?
Old person versus old person. And they force them to do all this heinous stuff. Well, in one of the apartments, they find this guy who's basically like catatonic. Like, and they're trying to feed him and they're being a real dick to him. But then they end up finding this kind of locked chest in his room that's got in all of these crazy swords. And through all of this, they end up locating inside that building. They find two, I'll describe them as kind of ghouls, demonic ghouls. They are all white, naked females who have sharp teeth and demonic powers, like they can climb walls and things like that. And they feed on human flesh. And you get the idea that they've kind of been living there for a long time because they've got newspapers and cardboard boxes and they've kind of built like a little fortress in the basement of this building. Well, the guys find them. And they kidnap one of them and they start torturing it. They tie it to a pole and not knowing what it is, the only thing that they know is it's hurt by sunlight. And if they put like biblical scripture pages around it, it like flails. They start torturing it. And so we're watching these horrible, horrible like woman-ish torture sequences of what these horrible kids and the one dweeby kid who doesn't want anything to do with this are doing to this demonic figure, while the other demonic figure realizes what's going on and goes on a rampage, killing everyone who is in a school uniform. Yeah. And so there are parts of this that I absolutely loved. And there are parts that I was like, this is hilarious. And then there were other parts that I was like, this is just like, there's a dart scene with an eyeball that it was just grueling. And some of the other torture stuff. And that only puts us about a third of the way through the movie. And then it just spirals into chaos. Mm. There's a lot I really enjoyed in this. Hell of a watch. Huh. There were definitely parts that I was like, well, this just took a really weird turn because it is kind of this crazy horror comedy about the dweeb and these other guys, and it's very high school drama.
I will admit, there was one night when we left, Sierra and I went out, and we left the kiddo to watch Joe Bob. And she watched Mon 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 Monsters. And I said, oh, I haven't even had a chance to watch that. And she said, yeah, it's – I think she said it was relevant. Like she connected to it like on a school level, like high school level.
Yeah.
And she was like, it had some stuff to say. And I was like, oh, interesting.
It really did because it's got a lot about the bullies and how you find out that the bullies, you know, of course, because they're bullying this dweeby kid who is not actually a dweeb. They're bullying this one kid. And then they're also bullying the elderly. So you get like immediately that they've got their own shit going on that is making them kind of lash out. And that comes out more and more throughout the course of the movie.
Clearly, you got to show her Martyrs next. Time you leave. Just leave her with Martyrs and go out on the town.
You know what? We were in Texas Frightmare. Sierra said she was watching Henry, and I was like, Jackie's not watching Jesus. Henry, please. And she's like, no, she's upstairs. So yeah, like, that is one that I will not allow.
Yeah. Wow. And definitely as it gets towards the end, it has a lot to say about bullying.
Yeah.
But you have to get through this really brutal, and especially the fact that they're bullying the demon too. You have to get through the bullying to get that messaging at the end, and some of it's like fucking heinous.
Sometimes like life, Becca. You just got to get through those challenges.
Way to bring it next level, right? Well done. So that's Mon 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 Monsters now streaming on Shudder.
You know what I saw?
What'd you say?
Reanimator.
Oh, that you hosted Rihanna.
Yeah.
But I was also
fun.
Oh,
no. You hosted the panel.
I hosted the screening.
You did the screening. We came late, and I watched it. I probably hadn't seen it in a couple years, but man, it's such a perfect low movie. People forget how like it's tight. It's like 88 minutes.
Yep.
There's not a single piece of fat on that film.
It's efficient.
It's funny as hell. But the one fun part, because I hadn't seen Jeff Combs used to actually come and eat sandwiches at Jump Cut, and he's always super friendly. So when I introduced everyone on stage, the highlight for me was he dipped me and then kissed me. And I was like, oh, that's pretty fun. Getting kissed by Jeff Combs when you're a 12-year-old boy watching that movie. My flashback to watching that film for the first time. I wish it was Barbara, but you know.
Did you get a Trump impersonation? impersonation from Combs?
He doesn't. Oh,
excellent.
Really?
One. Oh. Excellent. That's how we close it out. He had something to say about Trump, and then he like did an impersonation, and then he was out.
So. I think somebody just goes, oh, why can't you not talk about politics? He's like, bye. Yeah. Which is great. But it was really fun to watch them. And it was. I'm glad they got a lot of love there, because they seemed to really be bonding as a group. Yeah. And
yes.
It was fun to talk. I'd never met Bruce Abbott before. He seemed great. But Barbara, it's just watching the movie and then seeing Kinmont her again. Too. Yeah. Okay. But she hasn't. He really hasn't aged. Like, we're all joking about it, but I'm dead serious. I almost think she almost looks better. She just looks amazing. You know,
it's like Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
She's just like getting younger and younger, and then it like stops at some age. You know, it's just very unusual.
Reanimator is also a perfectly constructed script. Mm. If you go by traditional script writing standards of the inciting incident and exactly where it has to occur. When I was teaching theory at this was a wild day. I was teaching horror theory at Hunter College, and there was one day I was queuing up a scene from Dagon before the students came in, and somebody sticks his head inside my classroom and he goes, oh, you're showing Dagon. I wrote this. And I looked at him like, are you Dennis Paoli? He runs the library at Hunter College, or what, the writing center. He runs the writing center in the library. And I was like, well, you're coming back. And so I ended up, because since I taught the class for a couple more years there, I would always break down the Reanimator script as an example of perfect screenwriting and then have him come in and talk about it. And so, yeah, it's perfect. The way every single incident, new information, it's like they read the book on screenwriting and then wrote it.
You know, I want to go on a little tangent. I was listening to...
You don't need to preface that.
It's going into screenwriting in The Fly, and it was something I was thinking about. There's a podcast I was listening to. It was a screenwriting podcast, and they were talking about how, you know, how much time you need for character and motivation, and it made me remember that much like Reanimator, you know exactly who these characters are within like 5 minutes.
Yep.
You know, through their what they have to say and their motivation.
And Bruce Abbott's character has a perfect arc.
Yes.
Like from start to end, it's like the perfect arc of a character, which is
good. But I was thinking about Cronenberg's The Fly and how efficient it is in setting up Seth Brundle. Mm. Because in the first like 10 minutes, I mean, like usually you get a bunch of throat clearing and just like, oh, here's Seth Brundle, here he is at this party. They could probably get a bunch of stuff, but it's like Seth Brundle meets Gina Davis, and suddenly they're off and going, and you learn very quickly what he's doing, why he's setting up, and why he's doing it. He gets car sick.
Yeah.
He gets motion sick, and he's creating these things so he could teleport. That's it. That's all you need to know, and you know exactly who that character is in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't need to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so amazing.
And the key to the whole script is cheeseburgers. Yeah. Like that's the moment where you're in. I feel like, you know, you're watching bad science and then it's like human.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's a great script.
I've read arguments that actually find The Fly very problematic in a horror sense because he's never portrayed as a monster. He is the monster, but that we may watch him do these disgusting things, but it's always presented as like a pity thing.
Well, not there, but the sequence where he goes out on the town and he like breaks, like he arm wrestle and he's kind of gross and he picks up a girl. It's like that's where he's pushing against it and it's kind of gross, but it's such a perfect movie. I mean, I remember showing it about last year and hadn't seen one. I was just like, oh my God.
I never want to hear the words The Fly and problematic in a sentence.
I know, right?
Boo. That's bullshit. Yeah.
It wasn't your theory.
No. It was first raised by Noel Carroll, who's like very, very famous for his philosophy of horror book. He raised it, but he didn't call it problematic. It was some of the he called it like, you know, he's not portrayed as a monster exactly, but here's why that is okay in the world of horror. And then it was some of the responses to Noel Carroll that were like,
But Frankenstein's
like that. You know what is problematic? The conversation that we had at the bar at Texas Frightmare, in which we were all drunkenly talking about how fans have placed two characters in a relationship, like an imaginary relationship, and created fan art out of this. Rob, were you part of this conversation?
No,
you weren't.
So
as kids say, they were shipping characters, and in this case, it was Kerry White and Michael Myers.
Yep.
And I looked it up. I Googled it, and there's tons of fan art of Michael Myers and Kerry White hanging out together.
Kerry White from Sex and the City.
Carrie.
That would be Carrie Bradshaw, and I've never even seen that was, an episode is of even Sex better. And the City.
I want to see
we just got to peek inside Elric's head tonight.
I was just imagining those two together. Go, fuck, that's hardcore.
No. And then Samara and Jason Voorhees.
That one I've actually seen images from.
Very weird. But I'm like, what is it? What is with these like non-speaking, brutish villains and teenage girls. Like, what the fuck is that? What is that?
I don't.
Because they're both teenagers. Yeah.
But I think that that exists in all levels of fandom, that idea of putting weird characters together in a sexual relationship.
That's fine, man, but make it age appropriate.
I don't know, but like, okay, so when another example of something that a student brought me that I was like, what the fuck? I remember I was teaching a class on fan fiction and somebody brought me fan fiction from My Chemical Romance that was online with the two brothers having a relationship. And I was like, this is so
Well, that's when you
wrong.
Start getting into like, what's his face? The two brothers from Supernatural, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you're going off on fanfic adventures that are just
And also Picard weird. And Riker. I read it. Thought we all did.
I mean, where's our fan fiction?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God, don't encourage it, Ryan. Don't encourage it.
It can all be about Ernie. You guys can send us your Ernie fan fiction and that man right there.
They're just shipping Ernie with all, like, what's her face from Return of the Living Dead 3?
Wait, what does shipping mean? Like, is that, it's like, what
I
is
don't
that
know. My kid says it, you know, like, it's like, they're just like abbreviating relationship, I think. There could be teenagers listening to this going, old man Turek, shut the fuck up. I think that's what that
means. It's a sexual term you don't even know about yet.
Speaking of which, the greatest shirt, the greatest like shirt shunting. We saw at this festival was Shockwaves with our design and Chill. And that was the greatest moment. Well, I think we posted elsewhere.
Does that mean people are listening to us while having sex?
I know. I don't want to think about that part.
Because I remember I said to her, as long as it's not at 1.5 times
well,
speed.
Here comes a really exciting part. So start dropping those drawers because here's a word from our advertisers. This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers.
AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing to fantastic, irreverent reviews, to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes that there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for just $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. Again, 30 days for free on Shudder. Just go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES.
In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. And now, this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue 4. We're celebrating in style. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. If you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, issue number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. That's SHOCKWAVES for 10% off at Fangoria.com.
You know where the Shockwave team shops for horror, cult, and strange films? Diabolik DVT, which features demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online right now at www.diabolikdvd.com. That's DIABOLIKDVD.com. Right now at Diabolik, Marian Dora's Harsinoma on Blu-ray with a limited edition slipcase. Also, all of the Agfa and Something Weird titles, including Ninja Zombie, Blood Lake, and Lady Street Fighter. And also all the latest from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. For all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
All right, we're back. Hopefully you had some good chill time after you shockwaved and chilled.
Yeah.
We've got a terrific guest on. She is single-handedly responsible for my job.
Oh, we'll get there.
We know that.
We're going to get to that. I have a lot of questions for her.
I'd like to welcome on Chelsea Stardust.
Thank you.
What's up, Chelsea?
Hey.
Welcome.
This is the year of Chelsea Stardust. She has a film on Hulu as part of the Into the Dark series called All That We Destroy.
Excellent stuff.
She just wrapped on Satanic Panic for Fangoria.
The second film.
And that'll be making its premiere at the Overlook Film Festival later this month.
That's true.
Congrats.
Holy smokes.
This is a long time coming, Chelsea.
Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Where do we begin? I mean, Chelsea and I met, I think it was around Paranormal Activity 2.
Yes, because I remember you coming into the Blumhouse offices, and I started here in the top of 2011.
Right.
So that's probably.
Yeah, you were on the Paramount lot, and it was you and Mickey Keating.
Mickey wasn't there yet.
No, Mickey was there.
Oh, he was there?
Yeah,
I don't remember him being at that
Because
office.
I remember Mickey looking at Shock Till You Drop as kind of a suck up.
Oh, okay.
So it was you sitting one way facing the door, Mickey his back to the door, and I sat down, and you were like, please wait for Mr. Blum. He'll be right out. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then I was like, oh, Mickey, I see you're looking at Shock Till You Drop. And he's like, oh, I read all the time. And then,
convenient.
And then you were like, I did too. And that's great. And I was like, cool. And then we started talking tattoos. And then you talked about your Alfred Hitchcock tattoo. And then basically I said, we all just need to be friends.
Wait, where's your Alfred Hitchcock tattoo?
It's on my shoulder.
I've never seen this tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's on her back.
The night is young, Elric.
keep her drinking.
Only if you let me touch your face.
Don't touch that face.
But let's start at the top with All That We Destroy. This is
that was a leap.
That was a leap.
I thought you were going back in time.
No, we're going to lead with the thing that she's promoting, which we want everybody to see, which is a new film on Hulu. So I'd love to hear a little bit about where it got its beginnings.
Yes. So the writers of All That We Destroy, Sean Keller and Jim Agnew, wanted to write something for me to direct. And they pitched me this idea. I loved it. And they wrote it, and it was really nice because as they were writing it and developing it, I could chime in and give notes. And when we were talking about it, they kind of pitched it to me as Psycho meets We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Nice.
I said, sold. I will take that. And I was also really attracted by the what a mother will do for her child, which Cujo and Poltergeist and Exorcist, like those are some of my favorite movies. And I really like those parts of those movies, mm-hmm. like that focus. A woman's willing to entertain an exorcism, a woman's really willing to go to another dimension, and a woman's willing to take on a killer dog, all for their child. Yeah. So loved the script. And I remember after I left Blumhouse and you, Ryan, were here sending lots of scripts for consideration. I think I sent 10. I just counted them up the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And, or I sent 9, and you're like, pass. And then I pitched you All That We Destroy. You were like, that one.
Oh, yeah.
And then I sent it to you when it was ready.
Yeah.
And took it off the pipeline. And everyone said yes.
And it was less than, and I think it was a little bit more needy than just saying that. I was just like, Chelsea, this is incredible. I love this idea. And you need to make sure that you send it to no one else but us.
Yeah, pretty much.
Can we elaborate a little on the idea? Because because obviously, hopefully you've seen it by now if you're listening mm-hmm. to this. But if you haven't, go see it immediately on Hulu. And I remember Sean, one of the writers, telling me this idea, which basically, again, you were saying what a mother would do for their child. And in this case, the mother, Samantha Mathis, which is amazing. As I've always been a big fan of her. But basically, she is aware that her kid is a budding serial killer. And he's had one kill. And it's kind of slightly in the future because she is able to clone his first kill. And so basically she keeps doing this so that he just, rather than kill other people, will just keep killing his first kill over again and over again.
He's had two by that point.
Was it? Oh, technically, but that's a spoiler, Becca.
No offense. I was going to say some spoilers. So if you haven't seen the episode, you should just pause.
All right, we can spoil a little bit. But no, great concept and very cool. And also it felt kind of like a Black Mirror to me. That's kind of the vibe. Yeah. I don't know if that's what you guys
are
going for.
Very much. I mean, like for me, this wasn't just because she was coming on, even though we all love Chelsea. For me, it was the first one of any of these. I liked the what was the last one? April Fool's Day. I thought it was really cool.
I'm just fucking with you.
But they all, a lot of them feel kind of like, like 1 hour things that even though they're a bit longer, they don't necessarily always feel like movies. This one really to me felt, it could have also been an episode of Black Mirror and I wouldn't have blinked in that sense in terms of the tech, because it's like you say, it's only set slightly in the future and not in a way. Actually, afterwards, I was really jealous because of the iPhones that glow and I kept going, oh, that's pretty hot.
I liked the clear glass things where, it was nice.
But I just think it's, I think it, on a technical level, it's very assured and it really pulls you in. I love kind of loop stories as well, like whether it's time travel or whatever, and it has that because in a sense, it's almost time travel for the girl who keeps getting, you know, I guess resurrected in a sense or cloned. And also great performance by, well, everyone's really good in it, but the guy from Happy Death Day is fantastic
because
we haven't seen that side of him in that series. So it's really nice to get to see him.
He's so likable in that movie. Yeah. Like you fall in love with him immediately in the Happy Death Day movies. And this, he's definitely channeling that Anthony Perkins.
Yeah.
But really nasty kind of.
Well, because you get to see the turn. You get to see him kind of normal teenage kind of guy, nice-ish. And then you get to see him go as far and it's so quick. And I don't know. I think it's a really strong piece. Like I was really sucked into it, I got
to
say.
I have to say what I was really impressed by is how smart you guys were with the technology that you went and you established that it was slightly in the future. Like they had cooler phones than we do now. But then you didn't get bogged down trying to explain all of this. It's just, it's slightly in the future and she's working on shit that's even beyond that. So things like the biocomposter or what the black goo is.
Yeah.
We don't need to know any of that. And I think that there's a version of this film that it feels Splice-like where it's like really into the tech or what happens or how it works. And I was so glad that you did not do that.
Yeah. Another big model for this was Ex Machina too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Was a big influence, but and yeah, Israel exploring this like very dark side. He had not seen Psycho before.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I'm like, you may want to see it to like know what we're talking about. But he, I do know he, after doing the movie, and I showed him an Aurora, a very early cut of it. And I know he like went into some therapy afterwards.
Oh, wow.
What?
Yeah. Because he was just like, he had never done anything like that before. Yeah. And he had to go to a very dark place to do that role. And I remember I was talking to Chris Landon about the movie and he was sort of like, whoa, I did not know that side of Israel was in him. And I'm just crushing everyone's like Carter dreams from him. Yeah. and the other thing like that I loved about the script was the idea of, we still don't know this, but with serial killers, are they born that way? Is that something that's in their DNA, or is it like nature versus nurture? Is that something that could have been prevented with how they were brought up? Or I think like Jeffrey Dahmer is a very good example of that, of like, could his life have been different if his upbringing was different? Mm-hmm. And so again, spoilers, I'm going to say some spoilers. There's that moment when they're in the cemetery or the pet cemetery and, you know, Samantha's talking to Aurora about, death and every breath is precious and how important it is to fight. And the two sides of that is she telling, or she's telling Aurora this so Aurora will fight for her life, which makes it more satisfying for her son to kill her. But at the same time, she's also arming her with the tools to survive. Mm. So maybe in her subconscious, she will kill her son and then she can start over with him, which at the end of the movie, that's, she, you know, clones him and it's like, will he be the son she always wanted or will he be a killer again? Mm-hmm. So, and that's yet, you know, there's the, what we have for the sequel. So.
And it's the episodes of this where they don't hit the nail too hard on like, this is a Mother's Day, this is a Valentine. For me, I didn't even know which day until the end of the movie. I was like, this is like the perfect Mother's Day film. Like by the ending, it's like, it's ideal. And so it's really nice that, I mean, I don't know exactly how all these films were produced for the series and the backstory to that. But at what point did you know you're part of that series?
It was pretty much like right after we were shooting. Because I think like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we were shooting and then after it was done, like TV got a hold of the script because Into the Dark had just like been greenlit and they saw it. They're like, we want this for Mother's Day. Like it was basically the first one on the slate. But again, like we shot it in last January of 2018. And, you know, so they were sort of like, okay, well there's some time to wait before it's Mother's Day is here. So, I was picture locked by the time I went to do Satanic Panic. And then when I came back, all of a sudden it was time to finish both movies at the same time, which is really intense. And I don't think anyone should do that. But they just read the script and they're like, we want this. Like, for Mother's Day. And I said, yes, for it to be on Hulu, it's going to so many millions of people watch that,
yeah.
you know, series and Hulu in general. And I said, you know, more people are going to see it on this platform than a lot of other ones. So I was really excited about that.
Yeah, I don't think it lost anything. I mean, it'd probably be nice to see all these on big screen, but in the same way that Black Mirror episodes feel cinematic, even though they're television, you know?
Yeah, and we did get to have a screening for it. Like, I wanted to see it on a big screen. Like, all of these have played on a big screen in some capacity. So it looked great on a big screen. But also, I know people have big TVs, so.
Yeah, that is true.
I really enjoyed your artwork in it.
Yeah.
Like, how did you select the artwork? Mm-hmm. And some of it was so abstract that it was kind of in a movie that, you know, you definitely had a very simplistic set dress because of the time period.
Yeah.
It added this, like, crazy element of style to it.
I'm so glad you asked about the artwork. So the artwork that's on the walls in the house is done by my parents. So with the exception of like two of them, and at the art gallery, a couple of those are my parents. The rest of the art is all Shannon Keller, who's Sean Keller's sister, one of the writers. And she did all of the pieces that Israel is drawing, all of his artwork. She did that for the movie.
Wow.
Which was amazing. She had a couple months to do it. We also had to have the movie cast before she could do a lot of the art because it's Dora and it's Aurora, and we had to make sure that those were our actors. And yeah, all of the pieces, we didn't make any copies of them, so all the ones in the film are the original pieces of art. And that was a really fun process working with her. Also, that's her aesthetic of like the piece of Dora that gets framed at the art gallery. You know, that's her thing that she does. So it's like these bodies made up of constellations or of all sorts of weird nature, spiders and snakes and honeycombs. And her artwork is amazing and all for sale. And you can find her on Instagram. Shannon Keller is her name. But yeah, that was a big part of the movie. And, you know, as both my parents are artists. So anytime I can put their art or someone else's art in my movies, I enjoy that very much.
All right. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Chelsea was born in a pumpkin patch.
Pretty much.
Not far fetched.
No, I credit all of Chelsea's success to being the best, not all of them, but being the, what's the word where somebody's, what is it even called? Like when you always follow up with like a card or a letter. It's like
etiquette.
I don't know what it is, but I remember being at Jump Cut one day after you did a live script read and then getting just the coolest card from you the next day and just realizing I don't think anyone's ever done, like sent a thank you, but with real detail. And I would say every birthday, every Christmas.
I send
Christmas.
You a fucking card every Christmas.
No, you've
Elric.
Never given me any.
I send every Christmas birthday, cards, but Christmas Chelsea I hear from is the Chelsea. Only birthday card I
no,
ever
birthday,
received.
Christmas, thank
how
you.
How could you ever dislike Halloween. Someone who is that awesome? And I just remember really liking that.
Oh, yeah,
so.
She always sends – I always get a Halloween card from
yes,
you.
Halloween
and
a mix.
No one
and
else
a
sends
mix.
Me a Halloween
yes.
card.
Always a Halloween mix.
Halloween mix, yeah.
I'm the reason the post office still exists.
Yes.
Unfortunately, every viewer of All That We Destroy is not going to get a thank you card.
No.
That would be difficult, but you're very good at that stuff.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it's nice. Chelsea,
all my mom.
What was the horror film that started it all for you?
Well, when I was 10 years old, my dad showed me Night of the Living Dead. Mm. And I said before, both my parents are artists, they're fine artists. My dad, when he was in undergrad, he was in film school as well. He was a fine artist, but minored in film at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, which is where David Lynch went. And he was in class with David Lynch.
Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia, yep. And so he was a cinema lover. And as far as I can remember, I was watching movies every Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. First movie he took me to when I was, the year I was born was Back to the Future, which is why it's my favorite movie of all time, I think. But basically when, you know, I was raised on the Universal Monster movies. So Dracula was my favorite. Halloween was always a really big deal in my household. My parents had parties every year. I grew up on a farm, so we grew pumpkins, we carved them. It was very magical. And then, you know, I loved the Universal Monster movies so much and Abbott and Costello. And then he was like, okay, I think it's time for you to graduate. Like, what's the next thing I can show you? And he said, if this movie is too scary for you, we'll stop it. We'll turn it off. I was like, oh, well, that's a challenge. I'm not going to turn this movie off. And we started Night of the Living Dead. And I was like, just at the very beginning, the music, the black and white. I was like, oh, this is not I don't like how this is making me feel. It's really creeping me out. Like this, the score just instantly was unsettling. And I was like, okay, I can watch it a little longer. It's okay. And then they're coming for you, Barbara. It's like, oh God. I'm like, I'm kind of scared. He's like, oh, okay. So do you need me to turn it off? Are you done? You can't handle it anymore? I was like, no, I can watch a little more. And then, you know, the minute she gets to the house and, you know, we start seeing the dead approaching and I was in. I was like, this is it. This is what I want. And then I obsessed over the movie and would watch it as often as I can. And then I had to have babysitters come and I'd show it to them. Nice. And a lot of my babysitters were Amish because I grew up in Amish country and they were traumatized because they don't watch TV. They're like, what is this? Why are you watching this? From that point on, I was like, those are the movies I want to make.
How did you, at that age, how did the end seem to you? Obviously, we always talk about the end now politically, but at the end, did that have a different
kind of... traumatized. I was like, what? He lived, but then they killed... Like, I couldn't wrap my brain around how horrible the ending was. I was like, but he made it, and he died. And then, of course, my dad and I had a very long conversation about it on a much deeper level. But I was shook, as they say. Yeah. But then I just wanted to... I would put on plays with my friends and I would shoot short films. And when I was in high school, I took a continuing education course at the Cleveland Institute of Art and with this filmmaker in Ohio named Robert Banks. And he just was like live and die by film. And so I made movies on Super 8 film and cut and splice and we drew on them. It was very experimental and fun. But he loved horror. Horror was his thing. So when I was done with the class, and he's like, what have you seen? And I was like, you know, this A, B, C, and D. And he's like, oh, no. And then he brings a stack of VHS tapes, which are just recorded off of other movies. And he's like, here you go. Good luck. And in there was God Told Me To,
yes.
The Hills Have Eyes, Martin, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
It's like classic hits for me. Mm-hmm. I love that we get to be that person to somebody. Yeah. That's one of the things I love about doing this is like to somebody, if you hit the right moment, the right podcast, you get to be that person who passed on that thing, that key moment. So,
and I remember watching those movies anytime my parents, I was kind of being sneaky about it because they let me see pretty much whatever, but horror was something where they were very particular about. It was very catered. It was like Poltergeist and it was Christine and it was The Shining and Carrie and but sort of the darker ones, I would wait till they would like leave to go to the grocery store or something. And then I'd sneak and watch them on TV or wait till they were in bed or wear headphones or whatever I could do to watch them, put them really low on the TV and sit super close. And then I was just ravenous in high school of like going to the video store, Video One, and renting anything I could get my hands on and just consuming, having a friend come over and watching them at her house because her parents didn't care. And, you know, just seeing everything I could get my hands on. And it was all over by that point.
Do you remember any of those darker, weirder ones that particularly popped?
I remember Extra.
Shit. Now you're talking the right team.
Yeah.
You saw that a lot younger than I did. I only saw it a few years ago when we were all talking about it.
Yeah. But also I discovered like American Psycho. Uh-huh. And I remember that I'm a huge John Hughes fan and seeing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 cover. Like I was obsessed with the covers of the video store. So I'd go through, I'd pick up every single one, flip them over, put them down. There's ones I couldn't watch, like Child's Play. I was way too scared to see. And then I saw it. I was like, oh, I mean, it's scary, but it's not like what I had built up in my head. Candyman, which had a huge impact on me when I saw it. Carrie was obviously another one, but I just could not stop. Leatherface. I was like, this is amazing.
That's come up a couple times.
Yeah, Leatherface gets love today.
Yeah, that's good.
But whatever, you know, and the scarier the cover, the longer it would take me to watch it. And I remember like some of the Nightmare on Elm Streets took me a while to watch because I'm like, wait, he's eating a girl? Like what? What's happening? I don't know if I can watch that. Anything I could sneak around and watch. And then by the time I was 17, they didn't give a shit. But they're like, you can watch whatever you want. Yeah.
Was there a clear moment? Was it years later than that, besides making stuff with your friends, where you went, oh, this interest of mine could also translate and I want to create these things with, you know, beyond just for amateur fun?
But basically it was like when in high school, when I was like making, I asked my teachers, I'm like, instead of doing a paper, can I do a short film? And they said, yes, of course. And no one else was doing that. And I went to a teeny tiny high school. Our graduating class was like 80 people, in very rural Ohio. And then when my parents were like, what do you want to do for college? And I said, film school. They're like, great. What's your minor going to be? Like business or whatever. I said, theater. Oh, great. Okay. And then after film school, it's like.
Where was that? Which state?
Ohio University.
Oh, okay. Big school, right?
They have, that's OSU. Oh, okay. OU is like much smaller. Okay. But the great thing about OU is that they had so much equipment and everything was shot on film. Like we didn't have, I think I did one project on digital, but it was still loading a Bolex and shooting on Super 16, and very thankful for that experience. And then after that, I like moved to LA and I've been here ever since. So this is my 12th year here, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And if anybody's out there is wondering what a Bolex is, Google it.
I think I have two Bolexes.
You're only able to shoot for, what, 30 seconds at a time?
Yeah. Three minute rolls.
Yeah. Just wind it.
You don't even need a dark bag for some of them. You just shoot
that shit.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah, I love it.
I remember.
I shot digital Bolex. I did a couple shorts on the digital Bolex.
Jim Koons was a
big Jim Koontz was my DP on that one. It shoots completely raw footage. So then I was like, wow, I have just as much work to do now.
These cameras were little tanks. I remember there was a Bolex that was on a tripod and they had the head up really high. And I remember someone like walked into my dorm room and knocked the entire thing over and the Bolex just came cascading down and clipped somebody's arm and then hit the wood floor and it took a giant chunk of wood out of the floor. Bolex was fine.
They were shooting those things in the war, right? Yeah. So it's like those things were tough. Fuller and those guys. It's kind of wild. I mean, that is kind of – there is a little bit of magic there. Like when you watch digital and people make mistakes, you never use the mistake in digital. But in film, if you made mistakes and jumping out of the thing and you're getting double image, you always use that in your edit. No one cares. I love it. It's so cool. I feel bad for young people now. They don't get to experience this. It's kind of sad.
Puts hair on their chest.
Yeah, but they get as many takes as they want.
Yeah.
As much space as they want.
But even actors, like, this exact question came up on my Reanimator panel this week. And I said to Jeff Combs, like, what do you think about the difference of film and digital? And he agreed. The tension that film creates for an actor is a great tension. It's like this thing that you just know it's game time.
Yeah.
But with digital, you can literally push record and just keep going. Yeah. There's no end in sight. And I was like, totally. It's kind of.
Whereas Barbara disagreed with him, right?
Barbara was kind of like, no, I like the improv nature and like being. So it's, she does seem like someone who's really embracing modernity and how films are being made. So
kind of have to at this point. Like,
Now, Chels, before you wound up at Blumhouse, you dabbled with Judd Apatow.
Mm-hmm. So, my background before Blumhouse is comedy, which is kind of strange, but it's ultimately, I think, why I got hired for Satanic Panic, because I had a background in both comedy and horror. Right when I was sort of finishing up college, I had an internship at Heyday Films, which they were making the Harry Potter movies at the time. And after that, I went back to school, did my thesis, and then I got a call from the woman that I interned for. And she's like, I've moved companies. Are you still graduating like on time? And do you want to be my assistant? And she worked at Montecito Picture Company, which is Ivan Reitman's company. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, I'll be there in 5 days. packed up my life. Like this was right after graduation and drove across the country, started working for Ivan. But I was only there for about a year and a half because then I had the opportunity to interview to be Judd's assistant. And I obviously took that opportunity. It was really interesting going from like old school comedy to new school comedy. And the experience with Ivan was awesome. It was a very, very family-oriented, like Blumhouse. I went to his daughter's wedding. I went to his Super Bowl parties.
He made Ghostbusters,
yes. I saw like a Slimer in his office. Yeah. Damn. And
he also did Canadian exploitation films before that.
He did.
I've seen a couple of them are pretty grisly, actually.
Cannibal Girls. Is that one?
And one Cronenberg film, right? He was the first producer of maybe Shivers? He might have been on Shivers.
Shivers, maybe?
It's one of them. I know his name comes up on one and you're like, Ivan Reitman? It's pretty cool.
And so then I went to work for Judd for 2 years, and that was during Get Him to the Greek and Funny People and Bridesmaids. And that was that feels like a whole other lifetime. Mm. And of course, it's like getting to hang out with like Seth Rogen and Jonah Hill and Adam Sandler and the whole cast of Bridesmaids. But for me, I was geeking out because like I got to hang out with Janusz Kaminski and Bob Yeoman and hanging out with those guys was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And then, but at the same time, there was like when being a part of Bridesmaids was like very special. So Judd had four assistants, which I was one of the four. And right before we started shooting Bridesmaids, the entire cast, so all the women in the film, took all of Judd's assistants out for a night out in LA and rented a party bus. And we went to the Hollywood Men's Strip Show. Yeah. And we went to a bar. And I have video of all those ladies getting lap dances.
Amazing. So that's your power in this town, right? Yep. Your center.
She's got videos.
And just being a part of that was really amazing. But then...
Did PTA ever come to say?
No.
The nerdiest naked ass. Yeah,
but it's also, I wasn't very close with Judd, even though like there were so many things I wanted to talk to him about. Like he loves Hal Ashby. I'm a huge Hal Ashby fan, and he's a big Cat Stevens fan. And we just never really got a chance to like connect on that stuff. Cause again, he was in the middle of like directing a movie, producing a movie. It's pretty hectic, but I wanted to do horror. And he was like, I don't understand that genre. I cannot help you. Good luck. Mm. And so, you know, I had a friend of mine, another assistant hit me up and she's like, there's this guy named Jason Blum who's looking for an assistant. Are you interested? And I was like, Jason Blum, who's that?
Where was he at that stage?
So I looked him up on IMDb and it said The Reader since he found that property and Paranormal Activity. And those are the two.
Had it come out yet, Paranormal?
Yes, it had come out.
Okay, so you were aware of it.
I was like, oh yeah, I loved Paranormal. Yeah. And a sort of funny thing that was that happened right before that is when I was working for Judd, this sounds super Hollywood, but my masseuse at the time knew I loved horror because she saw my Hitchcock tattoo. And she said, oh, one of my clients is a horror director. His name is James Wan. Would you like me to introduce you to him? Huh. And I said, yes. Like I obviously knew who James was. And so she connected us on Facebook and she's like, Chelsea, this is James. James is Chelsea. She loves horror. You guys should talk. So while I was, you know, he was editing Insidious, we were chatting on like Facebook Messenger when I was like, oh, I work for Judd Apatow. He's like, whoa, what was that like? Like, he was very fascinated by the idea of like Judd Apatow because mm-hmm. it's such a different world. And
I also miss that Insidious period because he must have never slept. That was the only,
we were talking at like 2:30 in the morning.
I spoke to him the most while he was editing mm-hmm. Insidious on Facebook.
Yes.
It's like
yes.
all he did in between editing that movie. That's so hilarious.
Same thing. Like, this is 2:33 in the morning because I was like a night owl at that time. And when I came to work for Jason, so I interviewed with Jason. I said, I live and breathe this genre. I have a Hitchcock tattoo. He loves Hitchcock. Mm. Instantly bonded. And he's like, all right, let's try it out. And I went to that teeny tiny office at Paramount. His assistant was getting promoted. And it was just the three of us in this little office. And that was the top of 2011. And then Insidious came out in April. And I remember going to the premiere at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery and meeting James. And I was like, James? He's like, Chelsea? And embracing him because it's like, we've been talking for so long and we've finally met. And everything changed the minute Insidious came out for the company. And I just watched it go to a bigger office and then this beautiful big building in East LA. And just watching that journey. And then I was there until Whiplash went to the Oscars, which is the top of 2015. Which is crazy.
What, did you have a favorite production behind the scenes that you enjoyed just seeing it get made while you were in there?
I got to visit set for pretty much everything that was shot in LA. Obviously, I didn't get to be a part of Sinister because that was in New York. But Lords of Salem?
Oh, yeah.
I got to be in Lords of Salem. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So
I got to rewatch. Yeah. I like Lords of Salem. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I'm in the montage of all the women listening to the song.
Oh, yeah.
I have brown hair, though, and I'm in a sweater. I look very different. Huh. But that was really fun. And also, I loved Rob Zombie's stuff. So, but also getting to be on set watching James Wan work and Lee Whannell and Adam Robitel in a different capacity when I was shadowing him. But pretty much like any set I could get my hands on. The Purge, I got to be on that for a little bit. Plush. But...
Marked ones.
I love Marked Ones.
Yeah. Big fan.
I just saw Chris Landon. That's my favorite. Watching Chris Landon work.
It's so crazy. I love it.
Being on set for the Paranormals was pretty cool too. But
I just ordered Ghost Dimension in 3D, Ryan.
I can't commit.
I got to have that 3D collection. Man.
Thank you.
That's some collector mentality.
So what was the last production? It was Whiplash.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a high point.
It was a real bummer because I got hired December 2014, and I remember walking into Jason's office, Chelsea was there giving me the thumbs up, go for it, dude. Mm-hmm. And then I came out and Jason had basically walked into the office and was like, you're hired. I don't need to say anything else. You're good to go.
So Chelsea got your job. Well,
absolutely. She did. And then I came out and Chelsea pulled me aside. She's like, I'm leaving. And I was like, what? What the fuck, man? Because we were good friends by that point. Yeah. So I was like really excited to like get in and work with you.
And we had no overlap. I think in January at the top of the year. And right. I was like, yeah.
Well, and I didn't know the insides of any of this, but I was hearing it like where I jump cut, all this stuff was happening. I just remember being very impressed in a sense that you had a dream to make films. And I remember thinking you're now the assistant and probably could keep moving up that chain to something that's becoming huge. And there's probably going to be all these kind of much more behind the scenes roles that you could probably really do very well financially, all these things. And when I heard that you were leaving all that and you're just determined to make films starting with shorts again, I remember being genuinely impressed hearing that at the time, like not even knowing you that well. I remember going, well, that's pretty badass, and not knowing if you could do it or not, because that's a big leap.
Terrifying. Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's ultimately what dreams take, right? I think that's a big part of it. No matter how cushy this life over here is, you have to sometimes just go for it.
Yeah. Well, it's a valuable lesson.
Authenticity, yeah.
That you need to really, you really need to learn. You need to be on the job learning about when you're ready for it. Meaning, again, you have two movies coming out right now, but it's not like all of a sudden, hey, Chelsea decided to direct two movies and here they are.
Yeah.
There's 10 years worth of assistant work and being behind the scenes on a lot of stuff. So,
and shorts.
And shorts, yeah.
Yeah.
When did you know it was the right time, though? Was there something mm-hmm. specific that triggered that?
That's a great question. So when I took the job working for Jason, I was very clear with him that I did not want to be an executive. I said, I just want to direct. That's all I want to do. I don't even want to write. I want to just direct. He said, okay, I will help you in any way I can. But it's a very different, sort of a different track, because a lot of assistants, when they're at a production company, they want to be creative execs or DODs. That's what they want to do. And basically, it's like after 4 years here, I realized it was like, okay, I've been on a ton of sets. I've seen all these amazing directors work. I've talked to them. I've become friends with them. And I was like, I need to start making shorts. I haven't done anything since college. So I'm like, I need to have new content. Like, no one's going to look at my 16mm thesis from, 8 years ago or whatever. So it's like, I need something current, and I need to show I'm in touch with the horror climate at the time. And when I told Jason, I gave him 8 months warning that I was leaving, because to find a replacement is incredibly difficult, because I grew with the company, and for someone to just jump into that job is not easy. He's like, okay, well, you're the horror expert that's leaving. We need a director of development that loves horror. Who should that be? And I was like, I think I know of someone. And I texted Brian. I was like, would you be interested in this job? And you're like, 1 second. Yes. And then I pitched it to Jason. I was like, you should hire Ryan. Like, he knows the horror genre probably more than anyone else I know. And he's like, oh, that's a great idea. Cooper, like, calls Cooper and they talk about it. And they're like, okay, have him come in for an interview.
And you guys knew each other a little bit, because my memory is that when the first Purge came out, Jason did a little tour of it.
We
at
did
colleges,
a tour, yeah.
And you were doing Shock T Drop.
I was running Shock.
He brought you along for the Q&As, right?
Universal needed like an MC for each night on this Purge college-wide tour. And so I was hired by Universal. I didn't get anything. I just got a free flights and a per diem. And then I got content. So I was able to shoot video and stuff like that. But that was the most time I had spent with Jason up to that point. I mean, like that first meeting back on Paranormal 2, it was like a fun kind of casual interview in which he started grilling me on like remakes.
Uh-huh.
At the very end, he was like, what should we remake?
Halloween. It took a few years, but he got it finally.
but that was the most I had ever been exposed to Jason and talked with him, and then we just stayed, I had interviewed him at the Blumhouse House of Horror after that and stuff that. So,
yeah.
I only bring that up just so, like, when you say his name, it wasn't just like, who's that sort of thing?
There was
a little bit of history.
Yeah. And then basically to continue your question. So when I was, he basically said, so what's the plan? I said, I want to try to direct, direct short films. And he said, oh, well, you should be directing for Crypt. Like, you should direct with Crypt TV. I said, oh, Yeah, because they'll pay me to direct a short film. And nobody does that. Nobody does it.
And if anybody's wondering where Crypt TV is, you can go back a few episodes of Shockwaves, and we have the Crypt TV team on, so you can fill in.
But back then, it was Blumhouse? Or what was the relationship? Well, it still is?
Blumhouse has a financial investment.
It was Eli Roth and Jack. And
Crypt was based here at the Blumhouse office. They were in the other building.
Now they've grown and they've got their own people and all. It's all
bigger. Yeah. And it was like, it was a really, you know, sort of wonderful parting from here, because he basically like, okay, you know, here's a little nest egg to get your career going. And nobody does that. No boss does that for their assistant. And then said, okay, he hooked me up with Crypt TV and he's like, you know, go meet up with them and see what you can do. Yeah. And met with them. And then within like a month, I did the first one, which is Under the Bed. And then that was one they hired me for. And then Marco Polo and Project Hope were scripts I brought them. And then Slate Review, they hired me to do. So I literally did four over the span of like maybe 2 years. And of course, like being given a budget to do a short film is amazing. That never happens. Like I didn't necessarily get paid, but I could pay my crew, and the turnarounds were really quick, and it was showing like crafting a scare. And in the meantime, I was assisting other directors because I needed to pay my rent. And I realized, I was like, well, I spent so much time at Blumhouse that was so feature focused that I don't know anything about like television or commercials. And so I got a job assisting Carl Eric Rinch, who's a big commercial director. Mm-hmm. He also directed 47 Ronin back in the day. And that experience was amazing. And because I had no idea how commercials worked. And then,
he had a connection to Ridley Scott. I think maybe he was engaged to his daughter back in the day or something.
That I don't know. Okay. But and then I assisted David Straten on
Blood
Drive.
Gossip.
I know. I was like, I don't have that gossip for you. David Straten, who was doing Blood Drive at the time, I assisted him. I got to see a writer's room. And then when the shorts were – after I did all those shorts, I was like, I'd love to assist a director from start to finish. I can't remember who it was. Someone reached out to me, or I reached out to Blumhouse, and they said, oh, well, Adam Robitel is about to shoot Insidious: The Last Key. And I just met Adam at a dinner, and I reached out to him on Facebook. I was like, hey, I hear you might need an assistant. Are you – can I interview? And he says, no, you're hired. I know you. It's fine. And then I got to shadow him from, you know, pre-production into post. And that, after that experience, I was like, okay, ready for a feature. Like, bring it on. I felt like I had learned everything I needed to know. And Adam really had me involved in everything, he was a great mentor. And then by that point, I think I had finished that job in the next year. So 2017 is when we started prepping Destroy, and then we shot it in January. It was just like that. That's it.
What were like on Destroy being the first featured? What were some of the big learning curves? Because you had learned a lot, but you're always going to learn something on the job. Is it about time management? Is it about what was the big curve on that one?
Yeah. So it was the first time working with actors that I didn't totally know, because all the shorts, they were people I knew. I was like, how do I get people to do this for like $100 a day? But for All the Way to Destroy, it's like a proper casting session, which I hadn't gotten to do before. Because before I was just asking friends, hey, you want to be in this short? And I loved that process. I loved working with actors and auditions. And the minute I saw pretty much everybody was like first choice we wanted, you know, when we were casting. And I, of course, wanted to work with Samantha because I was a huge fan of American Psycho and Pump Up the Volume and Little Women and and all that stuff. And Frank Whaley was like the first person I wanted for that role.
Flock of Seagulls.
Yeah, right. the casting process, because everything was like on a feature scale. I mean, it's similar to a short, but also, I was very prepared. So we shot listed and storyboard, and I like location scouted, and we storyboarded to our locations and all that stuff because we knew we only had 15 days to shoot it. So I was like, we have to be really prepared. And overall, it was like a pretty – it's like after you finish a movie, it's like you feel like you've just gone through a war in a sense. It's just really, it just takes all the life out of you because you're just giving everything to your art. And after it's done, you're like, fuck, this was like so hard and this went wrong and that went wrong. And then when you see the movie all cut together, you're like, oh, there's a movie there. The whole thing went great. Like, and it's on my editor on Satanic Panic gave me some very good advice. He's like, you have to forget everything that happened in the production because all that matters is what's in the frame because that's all your audience knows. No one will know you had torrential rain or no one will know this happened or that happened. All they will see is what's in the frame. So that's all that matters. You got to forget about everything that went wrong. And Destroy, we were like, you know, we were pretty lucky. We shot every scene of the movie, which doesn't always happen. Stuff gets cut. You run out of time. Shot every scene. And I'd also worked with the actors ahead of time. Like we broke the whole script down scene by scene, line by line with the writers. And so I knew their intentions. And then I took that, my giant ass script, and sat down with each actor. And I was like, let's go through all the scenes and talk through all your motivations and what my expectations are. So then when we get on set, they knew exactly what I wanted. And we could just make little tweaks here and there. But we didn't have time. We didn't have rehearsals. We didn't have time to be like, all right, let's talk about the scene. Let's block it out. We didn't have time to do that. So I had to front load everything. But, you know, we did it. Made the movie. I'm incredibly proud of it.
And it feels pretty contained. So it seems like a smart first feature.
Yeah.
Like it feels like you're in mostly one space and around it. And so that seems like you're not spreading yourself too thin, which is good.
Yeah. And the other thing is before we even shot the movie, we had Umberto to score it. Mm. Like he's who I wanted from the very beginning. And I think Judson at Atomic Monster had turned me on to him. And because he did that, I don't know if you guys were there, but he did that live score to Texas Chainsaw
That's
Massacre.
Right, I remember.
Yeah.
Wasn't that causing a lot of controversy behind the scenes?
Yeah, it did.
I remember that.
And I told him and then my friend Stephanie Paris actually introduced me to him because I was like, wait, you know, he scored one of her films. So I was like, you know Umberto? And she's like, yeah, do you want an intro? I was like, yes. And That's so cool. I met him. I pitched the movie to him. I was like, I'd love to have you score it. And then it was like a year before he came on board. Because obviously, like with Into the Darks, there's other ones that come out before Mother's Day. So he was just waiting and waiting and waiting. And working with him was awesome. And again, hadn't worked with a composer on that scale before, short film versus. But luckily, I like knew Joe Bashara, and that was helpful. And Sean speaks the language of music since he composes himself. So that was helpful. I was like, this is what I'm trying to convey. He's like, speak in emotion. Just always speak in emotion. They
you mean
will
Sean
understand.
Keller, one of the screenwriters.
Sean Keller, one
Let's
of the screenwriters.
Let's just be clear. Yes. We are not just amongst friends.
Yes. So, I think that experience, and honestly, like so much time has passed. If there was anything like crazy. Oh, I do have a good story about our last day of shooting with Frank and Samantha, which is a Broken Arrow reunion.
Oh, wow.
They both live in New York, but they hadn't seen each other in a long time. And I told my sound mixer, I said, can you keep their mics on between takes? Because they started telling stories about back in the day. And so I'd be like, people would be talking to me. I'd be like, I can't listen. And I heard this is the most amazing story as they would talk about like New York in the 80s. And it was very fucking cool. So after we wrapped, I only had one day with Frank, which is the last day of shooting. And it's all the virtual reality space stuff, which we shot in Franklin Canyon. And, I went up to Frank and I was like, okay, I never do this. I was trying to play it really cool. And I was like, can I talk to you for a quick second? He's like, yeah, of course. I said, listen, I am a huge fan of Field of Dreams, which is one of the reasons like I cast you. He's like, oh, Field of Dreams, not Swimming with Sharks or Pulp Fiction or Ray Donovan, whatever. And I said, yeah, like there's this moment in Field of Dreams where your character, Archie Graham, gets into a van and with Kevin Costner and James Earl Jones, and they're, you know, talking about where they're going, and you say your name, you say, I'm Archie Graham. And the look that Kevin Costner and James Earl Jones exchange in that moment, how I felt in that moment emotionally, is one of the reasons I wanted to make movies. Mm-hmm. And he was like, whoa, like no one's ever said anything like that to me before. Cool. That's so nice. And I said, I hate to be a huge nerd, but will you sign my DVD? And he's like, of course I will. And he pulls it out and says, to Chelsea, you built it. It came. Your biggest fan, Frank Whaley.
Oh, wow.
And I cried. And then about 10 minutes later, when everyone was like wrapping up, I went up to Samantha and I was like, I am obviously a huge fan, but Sean like loves Pump Up the Volume.
Right.
And I was like, will you sign my super old school DVD snap that has the snap?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And she's like, of course. And she just wrote, to Sean and Chelsea, talk hard, love Samantha Mathis.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So those are just like these, like a great way to end the shoot. And I do have a video of me on Instagram, like after it was all over, because I was like, I want to remember this moment, like how this feels to have it completely done. And we didn't have pickups. We didn't have reshoots. We didn't have anything like that. And I said, I always want to. So I went up on this little hill in Franklin Canyon and just recorded a quick video. And I was like crying in it because it took so long to get here. And so anyways, getting emotional talking about it, but I owe a lot of that to Ryan. So
wow, please, no. Now moving quickly into Satanic Panic, how much time you were in post, but you were also doing Satanic Panic. So, I mean, like what was Satanic Panic was a film that you had to work for.
Yeah.
As opposed to, it wasn't something that you had written. You were a director for hire.
Yes.
Talk about that experience.
Yeah. So basically, I had been sent the script to Satanic Panic. I think it was in like December of 2017. So I was like getting ready to direct Destroy. And my friend's like, you should read this. It's insane. And I read it. I was like, oh yeah, this is batshit crazy. I can't wait to see who makes this movie because it's awesome. And I was like, fuck, it's written by Grady Hendrix. I'm a huge fan of My Best Friend's Exorcism and Horror Story and Paperbacks from Hell. I said, well, keep me posted if you hear anything about it. Went to direct All That We Destroy. And then I get an email from my agent, like maybe it was August, July, maybe. I think it was in July. And it was a script for my consideration. And I was like, wait a minute, Satanic Panic? I said, I've read this. I know what this is. And she's like, yeah, they're interested in, they would like you to read it. They want you to respond quickly. And I said, I've already read it. I'm in. Like, what do I need to do? What's the process here? I don't know. So basically they set a call with Dallas and Amanda. And I very quickly came up, I reread the script, came up with my vision for the movie and, you know, pitched it to them on the phone. And I think when I told them I came from Blumhouse, but also came from comedy, they're like, okay. I was the only person, I think, in the running for that project that was from both of those worlds. And then I remember, and I knew Adam Goldworm, who's a producer on it. And I remember he like reached out to me about it too. He's like, you really want to do this? I was like, yes. And then I was going home to Ohio to see my family for vacation. And I remember while I was there in my childhood bedroom, like writing this giant monologue, basically dissertation on why I should direct the movie. And I pulled all these stills and did music references and film references in this giant like packet. And I sent it to Dallas and Amanda. And I was like, okay, so let me know if you need anything else. And then I heard nothing. It was crickets for like a week. Maybe it was 2 weeks. And then I was like, okay, well, someone else must have gotten the job. And then my agents contact me and they're like, it's between you and one other person. I was like, what do I got to do? Tell me what I got to do. And then I think they requested to see Destroy maybe. Mm-hmm. And they saw that. And then I think they were like, okay, like you've got the job. You need to start casting right now. They had already started casting sessions while they were trying to find a director, just like, you know, self-tapes and things like that. And then I immediately started casting. And Destroy was almost picture locked at that point. And so started casting and then went to Texas I was there by September, like right after Labor Day, I think I went there. And picture locked Destroy while I was in Texas and then started prepping. And then we shot at the end of September, all through October. And it was an 18-day shoot and I was back here by Thanksgiving. And that shoot was intense. But I feel like All That We Destroy completely prepared me for how intense it would be. Mm-hmm. And I mean, LA, we're spoiled because we have sunshine every single day.
Yeah.
shooting in Texas was like, well, first off, Dallas for production value is amazing. Like these beautiful mansions we got to shoot in was so incredible. I was like, we couldn't get this for the budget this movie is. We could never have gotten this in LA. But they were also dealing with like a monsoon of rain, like they've like record breaking rainfall. So our first day of shooting was like a torrential downpour, like 40 degree weather. We had 4 location moves. It was insane.
I think they're just going through the same one we visited.
They were having tornadoes and stuff.
Kind of night shoots. We had like 2 weeks of night shoots. But honestly, like our crew worked so hard and we're totally, everyone was like so down with this like crazy satanic movie that has nothing to do with Satanic Panic. Because everyone I think thinks it is. But no, nothing to do with Satanic Panic.
Is the title reference anything in the movie? Or is it saying we should
know? No. Okay. It's a great title that no one had taken it. So.
Jump on it.
But also, ultimately what attracted me to the project was Grady Hendrix, Ted Gagan, because I was a fan of his films. Cinestate, I love Bone Tomahawk, Brawl in Cell Block 99. And of course, like Fangoria. I was like, yes, I want to do the first original Fangoria film now that they're back. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, Puppet Masters IP. So
Did you get to cast any geeky throwbacks like you did on the first one?
Okay. I did. So our cast is, I think Haley Griffith was the first person we cast who's an unknown. So they were like, they saw her audition. I said, this is Sam, the character Sam, who's the lead. And the fact that they were totally okay with casting an unknown to carry the film is very rare, but she is fucking amazing. And then we cast Ruby Modine, who I knew from the Happy Death Day movies. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of like built the rest of the cast around them. So Rebecca Romijn's a huge horror fan. She had never done gore before. So I was so excited. I got to do all sorts of crazy gore effects with her.
Had you seen Femme Fatale?
And yes, I have.
She's so good in that.
So good. I know. And Jerry O'Connell. And I got to talk to him a little bit about Scream 2 and Wes Craven. And so we have Jordan Ladd. Who's awesome in the movie, and Jeff Daniel Phillips, who's obviously in a lot of Rob Zombie stuff, and Michael Polish, who's also a director.
Is one of the twin brothers?
Uh-huh.
The Polish brothers?
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
I've seen their things, everything they've done back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then we also have like Whitney Moore and Clark Wolf, who are people within the horror community, and AJ Bowen's in it, and Arden Marin's in it, and... So we have Hannah Stocking, who's an influencer. That's actually, she's super cool and totally crushed. Her role is batshit crazy in the movie. But everyone was just fantastic to work with, especially in considering like the kind of shoot we had, which was really quick. No time for any bullshit and being outside in like 40 degrees and everyone was just here for it.
And lots of practical effects. Lots of gore
tons
effects.
Tons of gore effects.
Yeah. Who did your gore?
Tate Steinzeck.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Okay. From the Puppet Master films.
Yeah.
Puppet Master, the new one.
Yeah.
Well, what, without going into spoilers, what's the hard sell, Chelsea? How would you describe the film?
Well, recently I've been saying it's Evil Dead meets Jennifer's Body.
Hmm.
So,
okay. That's a good one. That works.
Yeah, that's sort of, but there's, the other thing I've been saying about the movie is there's just nothing else like it. And it is a horror comedy or it's a comedy horror. The tone, it walks that very fine line, which is really tricky. I think horror comedy is like really tough. And we, you know, obviously both Evil Dead, the remake and the original, I had everybody watch and Drag Me to Hell and Jennifer's Body. Also like I love Race with the Devil, though that's a little bit different, but it's mm-hmm. along the same lines. And Rosemary's Baby was another big one. But there's just, to me, when we were trying to figure out this meets this. And we're just like, it's so different. It's just, I haven't personally seen anything like it. And also there's things that Grady wrote into the movie that you've never seen in like American horror movies. You may have seen them in like, in Asian horror, but not in anything we've seen in the American market, like some of the crazy stuff that's in there. The set pieces, I can't wait for people to see. I'm really excited about that. But and our cast is fucking awesome. So
this is gearing up for festival runs right now. And you guys have a bunch of festivals I've seen pop up on your socials, right? Yeah. Like Overlook in Portland. Are there any others?
Portland, Cinepocalypse, in Chicago. That's all that's been announced.
When do we see it?
But
that's what matters.
You'll have to talk to Dallas. No.
And when soon. Do you have a nationwide release set yet?
Not yet, but we can talk about that offline.
Nice.
Things I can't quite say yet.
Chelsea, when are we bringing back Night Stalkers?
Oh my gosh. There's so that's what's like trying to figure out what's next is like the other big thing of like, I've been reading scripts and, thinking about like, what's the next step from here?
Well, you've done something that is a straight thriller horror film. You've done a horror comedy. What other kind of explorations do you want to take within the genre?
I'd love to do a slasher piece, and I'm attached to, I can't say too much about it, but a different sort of take on the serial killer trope that I'm excited about. There's also some things that I would love to get the rights to and adapt if I could, but everything gets like snatched up so quick. So it's like I'd love to do Heart Shaped Box. I'd love to remake Desperation as a miniseries. I'd love to direct Joyland. That's Taken. Like there's so, you know, it's finding the right thing that's available that I can get my hands on. I would kill to direct my best friend's exorcism. But you know, that's sort of, I've kind of been exploring, seeing what's out there. I've been looking into the rights for Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which is one of my favorite films from the 70s.
Still really unavailable.
Yeah.
Like it's not even on any kind of, just doesn't tend to even stream.
Yeah. I have a DVD of it that's bootlegged off of a VHS. And I have
kind of scary. I mean, Tom Berenger.
Oh, yeah. It's fucking terrifying.
You know,
especially in this like climate right now. I think there's a lot to say with that movie. I think it has to do with the music rights because it's all like disco music. Like I have the soundtrack on vinyl and I was like, I don't think
I can't
get
think
the rights
of any other
this.
Reason why it would be. Yeah. It has to be something obscure like that.
If only we knew a DVD or Blu-ray company.
Yeah. I know. I wish like, if anybody knows any, like.
They should also put out Pump Up the Volume if there is somebody in the room.
Somebody in the room.
These are Blu-rays.
Yeah, so usually it's like, I feel like music rights that, we're trying to get vinyl releases for both All That We Destroy and Satanic Panic scores. Wolfman of Mars did the score for Satanic Panic, and it's fucking awesome. You did a great job, totally crushed it. And we have like old school animation in Satanic Panic. I wanted the title sequence to be a throwback to Creepshow. So we were able to do that, which is really fun. And it's sort of like all the things I love kind of like thrown into the movie. So.
Nice.
Well, Chelsea, it's been great catching up.
Yeah.
It's just like hanging out with friends.
Why did it take you so long to come on, Chelsea?
I wish I knew.
Because we were waiting for the right time to talk about all the good things.
Because you actually had listened to the show back in the day, unlike some people, right?
Oh my God, yeah.
What are you getting at?
Who are you digging at?
Jesus.
Any one of our past guests? I don't know.
Oh my God, Elric.
What the hell? Elric's.
All right, so All That We Destroy can be found on Hulu as we speak. Just watch the internet for Satanic Panic updates. If you're at the Overlook Film Festival, check out the world premiere there.
Yes.
And keep an eye out for more Chelsea Stardust news.
Yeah.
Chels, thanks for coming on.
Thanks guys.